Has anybody ever died doing these?
In total of ocean, like combine the whole ocean rowing as a sport, I think there's been 7 deaths or lives lost at sea. A few of those have gone missing and never recovered. There have been a few that have folks have died aboard, whether it's exposure, heat or cold injuries. But yeah, in total 7, I think.
Well, you're not worried about that?
No.
Okay.
You can walk out here, get hit by a bus, and
yeah,
I think percentages are probably higher. Roll, 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 roll. I used to have big money, that was many moons ago. You used to call me honey, now you call me so and so. Cause there ain't no windows on the ship, and we can't roll, roll, roll. We can't roll, roll, roll. We can't roll. Living in the rock and roll. Roll, roll, roll. Every ball. Now listen, little papa, get on, had your big downfall. Cause there ain't no wheels on this ship, and we can't roll, roll, roll. We can't roll, roll, roll. We can't roll. We're moving in a rock and roll.
I'm watching this, I'm watching this Vikings Saints game, and the Vikings hit a fucking touchdown with no time left. A crazy 61-yard pass to win the game. Mayhem, fucking bedlam. Everybody's losing their minds. Celebration, fucking presses out there interviewing people. And this goddamn ref has to go, hey guys, come on, we have to kick the extra point. By rule, we must kick the extra point, as if it's a fucking, as if it's JFK's funeral, and they gotta fucking go through the motions. Nobody gives a shit, man. How about just, you can't even tie it with a block 2-point conversion and return. How about just, look at fucking Diggs posing on the bench, standing up for the, I don't care, arms crossed. We must. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm so sorry. We must do this. Honor dictates that we must kick this meaningless extra point. The Saints aren't even out there. The Saints are gone. They're like, we ain't coming out. What the fuck are we coming out for? Oh, no, they are coming out. Oh, they got 5 of them coming out. 6 people. They're like, all right, that's enough. Just fucking get out there. If I were there, if I were a Saint at this point, I'd be like, coach, I need fucking 7 grand. You want me to go out there for this meaningless goddamn shit? We just lost our season. We hit a field goal with 29 seconds left. And we're going to the NFC Championship game. And suddenly we're out? We're in the locker room? Everybody's wives are lined up to beat on them? As is an NFL rule. It's less publicized. They're busy beating their wives. And all of a sudden like, hey, quit it. We got to come out here for a meaningless fucking extra point. they're leading the chant. They're leading the Viking chant. The Icelandic Viking chant. This is so goddamn stupid. Why can't the ref just go, tactically, just so you know, we're supposed to get an extra point. I've talked to both coaches. We've agreed it's just going to be a kneel-down situation, so there's no reason to do it. Let's all just go home. That was the most anticlimactic last play of NFL history. Oh, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Ari Shaffir's Skeptic Tank. I have to go do spots and come back to do this later. I just realized I took too long. I'm a fucking procrastinator. I got this fucking podcast equipment out at 11:30 a.m. ready to do this, and it is now 8:10. Look at that guy whiff. That was crazy. That was nuts. Anyway, you guys. What a game. Fucking football. Once in a while. Sports in general. All right. Let's move on. Let's do this week's podcast. Tim Crockett is on this week. He is... Okay. A friend of mine, Leanne, who I met in Edinburgh, it's his uncle. He is going to do something crazy. He is going to row a 23-foot boat named the Kraken across the Atlantic Ocean. I'm just going to repeat that again. He is going to row a boat. One more time. He's going to row a boat across the fucking Atlantic Ocean. Not on the Atlantic Ocean, which would also be quite interesting to row a boat on the Atlantic. You know, go out to Dewey Beach and be like, hey, can I rent a rowboat? That'd be fun and maybe challenging with the waves. But no, he's actually rowing it across the Atlantic Ocean. yeah, there's a race called called the Talisker Whiskey Atlantic Challenge. More than 3,000 nautical miles. It goes in the Canary Islands to Antigua. You can find all this on his website, tamethekraken.com. Tame the Kraken. He's doing it to raise money for veteran suicide prevention, which is a good cause. You know, any sort of suicide prevention is great. And these guys aren't. Jesus Christ, man. He's going to row across the fucking Atlantic. He needs sponsorship. You know, if there's small businesses out there and want to, like, put your name on there, a la NASCAR, it costs a shitload of money to fucking build a boat. Aubrey, if you're listening from Onnit, he could fucking use a nice ad from you. Would be pretty cool to do an Onnit, would be on there. He's going to try to do it in fucking, Jesus, this guy is crazy. So anyway, we sat down. We were in Athens, Georgia, where I started my Wandering Jew tour. Actually, the day before I started, maybe that day, on a fucking freezing cold day. Monroe Martin got snowed in to New York, couldn't make it because of the polar bomb explosion, something like that. And we sat down and we just talked about this fucking crazy thing he's going to undertake. He's never done it. And he's rowing it solo. People do it in a fucking four-team group. And Tim is doing it solo across the fucking Atlantic. 3,000 nautical miles. Found out later, nautical mile is longer than a mile. I mean, granted, the best athlete I know right now in my life is Bert Kreischer. And even Bert Kreischer, even the talented Bert Kreischer would have trouble rowing 3,000 miles. I mean, I envy the fucking aloneness of it. That would be the best. Anyway, it's a fucking great. We'll talk about everything, and you'll see all about it. Okay, so let me get some dates real quick. Can I? Do you mind? Denver. This Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Actually, a lot of those are sold out already. But Ari Shaffir's Renamed Storytelling Show, coming to Denver. Dude, a fucking shitload are sold out already. Saturday, both shows Friday, Thursday. We gotta add a show. Damn, that's great. Well, get fucking Wednesday tickets then. I guess we'll add a show. I don't know what they do. Shows at 7:30 and 9:45 on weekends. Where are you going to add a show? Before? Maybe a late show Thursday. All right. Anyway, get tickets for that. It's going to be great. yeah, to the people who are hooking us up with fucking ski rentals, thank you. It's going to make the trip fucking worth it. Mini festival. I create these mini festivals. Everyone can have a good time. The show will pay for the good time. Then I'm coming back. I'm going to Boston. Tickets are at AriTheGreat.com. I'm going to Boston with Joe List at the Wilbur Theater. Two shows. January 27th, Saturday. Oh, the day before that at the Fox Theater at Foxwoods Casino on the 26th. Also with Joe List. Providence is sold out. And then Philadelphia. I'm coming there. February 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. Do you think there's a chance Philadelphia beats Minnesota and goes to the fucking Super Bowl and I'd be there? Would there be a chance of that? Salt Lake City, Wise Guys at the end of February, followed by Boise on the 28th. I had a list as the 27th. This is the 28th. Seattle sold out, I'm pretty sure. Calusa Casino in NorCal. Vancouver might be sold out on 3rd. And then the comic strip in Edmonton, 8th, 9th, 10th. Then I'm done. Am I skiing Whistler? Yes, I will. Where should I go in Utah? I'll have some time between Utah and Boise. Oh, Utah's with Ryan O'Neal. Boise's with Ryan O'Neal. Seattle, Ryan O'Neal. Of Danish and O'Neal. That's it. And then fucking, you know, at some point, hopefully. Australia, come on already with the dates. Fucking bring them already. Bananas Comedy Club. I don't know where the fuck that is. Somewhere near New Jersey, I think. April. That's too long. All right, you guys. What else? Also, the reason I was down in Athens, I guess I should just say this, is because I was paying off a bet, as I do all my bets. For all time, I've never not paid off a bet. I still have a few left for AAA. I got to fucking beg for $40 and then give it to a homeless person. Shove a hot dog up my ass and start a USA chant on a subway. I don't know how I'm going to do that. I think Saturday night's going to be the way to start the USA chant. But the reason I was down there is I was paying off a bet with Tim Segura and Bart Chrysler. By the way, on the way home, me and Bert went to New York afterwards, we're checking in. Bert loves fucking luxury. And so he's got the Ambassador's Lounge to wherever we're flying, American or Delta, and in Atlanta. And I was like, hey, man, did they call us when our flight is? He goes, no. I'm like, okay, because it's like, it's going to take off in 23 minutes. He's like, oh, fuck. So we ran down there. There were last people were boarding. He tried to bump me up on his fucking freaking flyer miles to first class. Did not work. But they're like, oh, you guys the last ones? And we were like, yeah. And they were like, Ari Shaffir? And I was like, yes. And they're like, and you're Bert Chrysler? The lady said it. I swear to God, the lady said it. She goes, you're Bert Chrysler? And I was like, wait, what? And Bert's like, oh, God damn it. And I was like, Chrysler. I'm like, yeah, like the car. He goes, no, Chrysler. And I'm like, no, like the car. And Bert's like, no, Chrysler. And she's like, is it no. And the lady's like, Chrysler, like the car. I'm like, yes, you got it, like the car. What a fun trip, though. What a fun goddamn trip hanging out with those two guys in Atlanta, drinking like crazy, eating like crazy, going to one of the best football games I've ever been to. Not as good as this fucking game, but the atmosphere in Atlanta, it was nuts. I mean, those guys have talked about it. If you want to listen to their podcast, Bert and Tom, me and Bert, I guess, and Tom did one for Bert's podcast from the Airbnb that night. And I'm sure Tom's talked about it, but it was fucking electric. I mean, you guys understand. I was in Athens 4 days before, 5 days before. That's all anybody could talk about. I started my show, my first show, and I went on the God mic from behind the stage. William Childress was there opening for me from Myanmar. Well, from Atlanta, but when I met, you know, used to live in Myanmar. And I was like, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming out. You know, they cheer normally. And I was like, people asked me why I wanted to start my tour in Athens. And I was like, well, I want to start somewhere that's about to win the national championship. And the place, I've never gotten a louder applause in anything I've ever done than I got off that. It's electric. What the fuck? It was electric. Absolutely electric. And it's 90 minutes away from Atlanta where the championship game is played. And I was like, well, that's a home game. But then I found out Tuscaloosa, Alabama is 120 minutes away. 300,000 people were coming into Atlanta from Tuscaloosa and Athens combined just to be in the city where their team might win a national championship. 300,000 people just there. They were advising residents to stay the fuck away from downtown. Just don't even go. Trump came. I didn't see it. He walked onto the field. I didn't see it because me and Tom were eating. We were downstairs. No, we were getting drinks. We would eat later. Dude, when there's a buffet, as there was, these tickets came with like free buffet food. So we get down there and immediately we see the sushi bar. And I'm like, hey, guys, while we discuss what we're going to eat, let's get some sushi, a couple pieces, which turned into seven. And then we centered on, I think, prime rib. Had too much of that, a little piece of pork, a little, you know, like shrimp thing. So now I've eaten two meals. And then I'm finishing. Tom ordered drinks and he was like, by the way, there's hot dogs and desserts over there. I'm like, fuck, I'll get a hot dog. So I got a hot dog and wings and dessert. When there's buffet food, look, I'm doing well. I have more money than I need. You know, I don't need a lot. My wants are very small. So I have enough to survive. I can afford, you know, $15 for a meal. And suddenly I'm getting this free buffet food and I'm like, it's like Holocaust mentality. I gotta fucking pound it. It's like I'm unable to stop, like a dog. You know how they say if you put like too much food out for a dog, they'll just eat until they die? Cats are better that way. Cats, you could just leave out food for like 3 days and then you leave. And then when you come back, they'll be like, oh, didn't even notice you were gone. Dogs, you come back, they'll be like, I couldn't stop eating. I'm so sorry. It's cold as fuck in my apartment. This heater does nothing. Anyway, it was a great time. And the tour started great. And I'm glad. I'm really happy about it. The Jew stuff, probably 35 minutes of it. I was able to hold their attention. This is a people in Georgia and then in Asheville. Went hiking in the Blue Ridge Mountains twice on the way to Asheville and the way back. Wish I had more time in Asheville. Seemed like a really cool fucking city. But the Gray Eagle was fun. But man, those Blue Ridge Mountains are beautiful. Just gorgeous. Fucking Bert, I gave him some honey and records that I bought. I bought some honey in the Blue Ridge Mountains, and I bought records in Athens. And I was like, Bert, can you take this back with me? Because you have a big, heavy suitcase that's got a hard top. It's not going to bend. Yeah, and then he just fucking stole it. He didn't steal it, but when we landed, I forgot to get it. And then I was like, hey, I need those records. And he didn't do anything. Then he made a post about Black Mirror. And then I was like, yeah, I saw that episode. It was amazing. Where are my fucking records? And he was like, you're not getting them back. Something like that. And I was like, I want my fucking records. I tweeted back at him. I'll kill you. I goes, if you don't give me my, I got a Mom's Mabley album. I heard about her from somebody like old, like my mom's like no, I'm on my step, no, in-laws, parents or something like that. They were like, Mom's Mabley is great. So I got an album that for $4, a Cars album for $8, the one with the chick on the cover smiling. Do I have a record player? No, but it'll force me to get one. Worked out twice. In the hotel gym to start my resolutions. Started learning Russian to start my resolutions. Anyway, so Bert doesn't get back. And I was like, dude, I'll kill you. If I don't get my records back, I'm going to home invade your family. And Twitter banned me. They're like, nah, you're out. And I think they didn't even give me notice. Usually when they ban me, they send me notice like, hey, you're banned for a week. Did you write this tweet? Please delete it. They didn't even do that this time. I think it might be a permanent ban. They don't get tone. All these people never get tone. It was the same shit as The Amazing Races when that was on YouTube. And people took it down. And they're like, how can you do this to people? I'm like, I'm not doing it. It's fucking a joke. It's from a National Lampoon's DVD. But there's no fucking nuance. There's no tone. What a fucking garbage, terrible time we live. I mean, it's a great time also. But in terms of that, where it's like, people just take things. And they just want to see the worst. They can't even imagine how something could be a joke or how something could be lighthearted. So anyway, I'm off Twitter for a while, which is probably good because that'll help me do one of my other resolutions, was to get off social media. What I wanted to do with social media was give control of it to... I have someone check my email. To like, it just gets too much. and then they put it in a category. So I wanted to have them. So if I needed to tweet something or Instagram something, just send it to them, to Kelly, and then have her post it, and then not let me have control, not let me have the password or anything like that. But I need it to like promote shows and podcasts. I need that, and also to like reach out to people to like for the Photoshop for the podcasts, and that's it. That's all I need it for. But I needed to promote shows, and now I can't fucking do that because I'm joked around with my friend. I'm not going to home invade Leanne and Island Georgia. For what? What am I going to home invade them for? Good home cooking? It's ridiculous. Almost ever charted. Oh, then I did. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's start the episode. Shall we? We shall. Oh, fucking 20 minutes of intro. Ladies and gentlemen, this guy, Tim Crockett is a fucking crazy person. He's crazy. He's so fucking cool. He got me jonesed up. I mean, really hyped up. And I can't row any of this, but the idea to take on this momentous thing. Aubrey, are you listening from on it? Sponsor this guy. Sponsor this guy. Help him pay for his boat. It won't cost that much. Put a fucking on it sticker right there next to the 7-Eleven sticker that's already there. Help this guy fucking row across the Atlantic Ocean. And for what? For shit you represent anyway. To prevent veteran suicide. Let's start the episode. Ladies and gentlemen, Ari Shaffir, Skeptic Tank, episode 313. Man, I've been doing this for a while. 313. Row, row, row your boat across the fucking Atlantic Ocean. No, no, wait. Row, row, row your boat gently down. Row your boat gently across the fucking Atlantic Ocean. All right, let's start. And if anybody wants to reach out to Tim to sponsor him, if you have a, or even like we say in this episode, with goods, not even money, but goods or services like Delta to help him get his boat to go back and forth, or FedEx for shipping things. Please reach out to him. Go to his website, tamethekraken.com. It's like that on social media too. Let me make sure. Nope. On Twitter, it's Row Atlantic. And on Instagram, it is Tame the Kraken. Okay. On Twitter, it's Row Atlantic. Why didn't you get Tame the Kraken on Twitter? It doesn't exist. You could have gotten it. Anyway. Reach out to him. Help this guy. Help this guy do something fucking nuts for a great cause. All right, let's start the episode. Thank you for tuning in, everybody. For my tour dates, go to arithegreat.com. Also go there if you want to check on all of the music selections. I'm done answering that question on Twitter. Well, I'm done on Twitter for sure. I post it on the website every week what the music selections are. Usually I post links to the videos of those songs. Go there, arithegreat.com or arishafir.com for all my tour dates and all the information. There'll also be extra details on this episode, like pictures of Tim's, this picture of him with the fucking explosion behind him, just being all casual. This guy is a fucking warrior. Jesus Christ, man. This guy is, it's like, I mean, he's like seven Berts, if that's possible. The Talisker Whiskey Atlantic Challenge. By the way, it's going on right now if you want to like look at it. There's an app. You can check. This one dude is fucking crushing it. They do it every year. I'm going to drink some Talisker tonight to fucking give it up for this. Okay. But before I forget, I'm sorry. I was searching for something. I couldn't find it in my brain. And I finally found it. Tom Segura's new special is out. It just came out on Friday. Brand new special. Number 3 on Netflix, I believe. Maybe 2. No, I think 3. You guys all got to go check it right now. Disgraceful. On Netflix. We were joking around with him before, but Tom's one of the best stand-up comics in the country. And then this country has the best stand-up comics. I'll stand by it. So he's one of the best stand-up comics in the world. I'm not saying that because he's my friend. I'm saying that because, like, legitimately, there's not 20 guys in the world that are better, more prolific, consistently hitting home runs than Segura. And his new special is no exception. You guys, I missed seeing some bands when they were in their prime. Nirvana, I never saw. And then some bands I saw like afterwards, like the Steve Miller Band. That's a terrible example. But like Smashing Pumpkins when they were already like done. Even Bush when they were done. I mean, you're getting a chance right now to see, I mean, a top comic. Forget about the guys who are famous. I just mean the guys who are great. I mean, how many of them are there that are just fucking top level and have been for this whole decade? He's in it right now. This is the equivalent of the fucking new Arcade Fire album coming out. Or I don't know who you're into. But like, he's right now comedy. And he's one of the best out there. So check it out. Go to Netflix. Disgraceful. Am I saying it right? Is that right? Yeah, I was getting it right. Disgraceful. David Letterman has a new thing? That's pretty crazy. But first, go to Tom Segura. Disgraceful. It's an hour, you guys. Go check out an hour of the best in stand-up comedy today. All right, that's it. Let's start the episode. Row, row, row your boat gently across the fucking Atlantic with Tim Crockett. Starts now. Thank you for driving out here, Tim.
Hey, appreciate welcome. It. Thanks.
What's that button? That's the Kraken?
That's the release the Kraken button. So now we're in the sort of final 12 months. We thought we'd roll that out and start to build some momentum towards what is like 340 days away from the start of the race.
Let's just first, I guess, say what it is. Like, you're going to row?
So I'm going to take part in the Talisker Atlantic Whiskey Challenge, which is a rowing race from La Gomera in the Canary Islands across the Atlantic to Antigua.
How far are the Canary Islands from here?
So straight line, it's around about 3,000 nautical miles. So that's about 3,200 normal miles.
That's the standard. When people say like cross Atlantic, they usually go from the Canaries to Antigua.
There's two, a number of ways you can do it, but the two kind of recognized routes is east to west and west to east. So east to west can be from the Canary Islands, which is this race, Tenerife, Gibraltar, Spain, that general sort of North Africa, southern Spain area.
Yeah.
And you could then go to anywhere within the Caribbean, Antigua, this race. I've got a friend of mine who's doing it solo in 13 days time, and he's going to set off from Gibraltar and end up in Venezuela.
Wow. So there's a world of people who do this?
Not that many.
It doesn't seem like it'd be thousands. Yeah.
I think at the moment, and my numbers may be slightly off, there's been, I want to say, somewhere between 120 and 150 that have successfully rowed across the Atlantic, and about 85 of those, I think, have been solo.
Okay, so let me just get this straight. When you say row across the Atlantic, What are we talking about?
So, unassisted.
Yeah.
So you have to be self-sufficient, so all your water supplies, any technical equipment, safety equipment on the boat, no outside assistance.
Unassisted, so not like Tour de France where they...
No, it is. As soon as you leave port, cross the line, then you get yourself to the other end by your own power. So you're not allowed to rig a sail. You're not allowed to put anything that could assist the boat other than the wind effects on the boat itself.
Okay. And you have a trailer boat, making sure you're okay?
Or so I've seen in the race that I'm taking part in, there are two safety boats. They're yachts that will follow the flotilla. This is an annual race. This year is the 20th 20th year that it's taken place.
Damn.
And at the moment, there is about 1,000 nautical miles from the boats at the front to the final boat at the back. So there can be quite a bit of separation based on the route that you take, the isolated weather systems that you may get caught up in, how big a team is rowing from solo all the way up to five-person teams, and kind of mechanical problems. So all that will affect how much time you can spend on the oars and how quickly you can get yourself across.
1,000 nautical miles. If something goes wrong, you're a while before they're going to get to you.
Exactly. And that's why...
Jesus, man. Jesus.
One of the reasons why I got kind of semi-approval from my wife to participate in this race is that there's a lot that goes into the construction of the boat, redundant safety systems, it's self-riding. You have a desalination unit that provides you with water that runs off a solar system.
Oh, really?
You then have a backup hand crank version. And then for those worst-case scenarios where, yes, everything's gone down, you have no power, and it could be 2 or 3 weeks before a safety boat can get to you.
Yeah.
You have emergency rations and emergency water stowed on the boat as well. Now, that is kind of within the confines of the race itself. Now, if something worse were to happen, fire on the boat, irreparable sort of damage, then like any other ocean-going vessel, you pull what we call an emergency beacon or EPIRB, and then any boat or vessel in the vicinity will be redirected to provide assistance. So early on in this race, a couple of boats got into trouble. I think one had an electrical fire on board, and they pulled their EPIRB, and the Spanish Coast Guard, I think, redirected a cargo ship to go and pick.
Oh, really? One of the other rowers pick up stranded rowers?
No. Because you have very limited ability to maneuver. Yes, you can, certainly where they are in the race at the moment with favorable winds and trailing seas, then you can get it to 10, 11 knots, maybe a little bit higher,
yeah.
Which seems fast, certainly when you're in a small 7-meter boat. But you can't exactly sort of like turn around and head off in a different direction at that same sort of speed to go and...
It's not like a lake.
...aid somebody, no. So a lot of the time it's just staying on course, providing some forward momentum, dealing with whatever the sea and weather throws at you.
Yeah.
And if cargo vessels, other vessels come close to you, which is obviously another danger of one of these things, that you have systems on board that will alert you, wake you up if you happen to be sleeping, and then you radio the boat, say, hey, can you make sure that you...
Can you watch out? Wait, how big is your boat? Is it tiny?
So it's about 7 meters, about 20, 22 foot in length. Some of the 4 or 5 crew boats are a little bit longer, but not a great deal.
Wow.
So yes, and you can imagine that gets lost. So it doesn't really appear on the radar. So it gets lost in the seas itself.
Yeah.
And you have another system on board that makes you look like 50 times bigger than you actually are. So you do appear on the radar.
Yeah. How long have you been doing this?
So my rowing experience, sort of, other than on a rowing machine or an erg in a gym, sort of totals probably about 4 or 5 hour long sessions in a rowing tank and a charitable rowing regatta in my own hometown about 30 years ago.
That's it. And then you were like, fuck it, I don't want to do this lock.
So I'm like, yeah, if you're going to be a bear, be a grizzly.
Where are you from? Are you from Wales?
I'm on the border of border of Wales and England, a little place called Hereford.
Okay, I think I've heard of that.
Yeah, it's about 130 miles west of London.
I got to get to Wales, huh?
So, yeah, it's funny how this sort of came about. It's one of those things that it's almost like, here, hold my pint while you go do something sort of thing.
How old were you? Were you just like a stupid kid who was like...
No, it was probably about, just over 12 months or so. I don't know if you recall that 22 push-up challenge that was going around drawing attention to kind of veteran suicide.
No, what was that?
So I think it was back in 2012, around about that time, the USVA released a report showing how many veterans were taking their own lives through suicide.
Like, it's totally crazy, like, 22
a day.
22 a day.
So what came out of that was this viral 22 push-up challenge where for 22 days you do 22 push-ups and then nominate a friend or friends to sort of raise awareness. So I got nominated, and obviously being a veteran myself, jumped on board.
Veteran of the U.S. Army?
No, British Army.
Is that? Do they have the same stats of suicide?
Pretty much so, yes.
Really?
It's, I would imagine it's probably wider than just the U.S. and U.K. But yeah, it's a lot higher than one would expect. So I got nominated, started doing my 22 for 22. And it was during around that time I reconnected through the wonders of social media and Facebook and all that sort of stuff with an old military buddy of mine that was on the sort of Navy boxing squad or the Marine boxing squad in the UK. And it was about a month later that I learned that he took his own life through PTSD.
Damn.
So sort of coming out on the back end of that with some former CNN friends of mine, we wanted to do more.
After you become aware already of the problem?
Yeah, it was sort of... But until it sort of really touches you or hits home, you get caught up in some of these things. I'm sure those that did the ALS challenge was kind of, yeah, did my part and have now moved on. But when that happened, I felt, I want to do more. And initially, myself and a couple of friends from CNN kind of started to do a spin-off of that 22, and we had a friend of mine doing 22 push-ups with the sea lions in the Atlanta Aquarium, and then we were going to sort of culminate this in a big production with Atlanta Football Club and a load of military guys out of Dobbins, but it didn't come to fruition. It was around about that time another friend of mine was also rowing across the Atlantic, but as a team of six for a UK charity. And I started following that, and I thought, this is kind of neat. And doing a little bit of research, I learned about the Talisker Whiskey Atlanta Challenge. Felt that was probably better suited to my circumstances, given the safety and the time it takes and all that sort of stuff.
Better suited rather than what? Push-up with sea lions?
Just getting sort of approval from the wife, work, yeah. All those sort of important
things. How does
your
wife let you do this? That's crazy.
I think I just caught her on a good day. She was half listening.
I'm going to go on a rowing trip. All right, sounds good.
Yeah,
you should. That's probably enough to know.
And she knows that kind of every 10 years or so, I go and do something crazy. So anyway, I found out about this, and I actually then went to one of the other guys that got caught up in this thing with me and said, hey, would you fancy roaming across the Atlantic as a pair? Like, and he was like, no. That's stupid. So instead of kind of delaying it or trying to find another team member kind of crazy enough to do it with me, I said, hey, there's guys that do this solo, so why not? And it's just gained sort of momentum from then.
Wow. And so what's the preparation like?
So a lot of people say that it's as hard to get to the start line as it is to row across. Obviously, it's a fairly expensive endeavor to get a boat built or reconditioned.
This isn't just a regular lake rowboat,
right? It doesn't look all that special, but it is. Like I said, it's self-riding. It can provide you with power, water, storage for all the important equipment to keep you alive.
You clean the ocean water and drink that?
So yeah, it basically sucks salt water out, puts it through a high pressure filter, and takes about 98-99% of the salt out.
And that's enough to...
Yeah.
Wow. Do you ever drink your own pee?
Several times, yes.
Yeah.
Obviously, being former military, it's kind of
really?
Rites of passage. So I would imagine it's probably going to be as warm, certainly given where you are in the sea, but probably a lot more potable than drinking your own pee.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. So the self-righting.
So yes, the boat is, again, you have ballast in the bottom, made up of your emergency water, anything else, your other equipment. And then the cabin or the cabins on top are sealed. So basically you have two bubbles of air, weight at the bottom. If you get capsized, it just pops itself back up.
And that's happened before?
Yeah, there's been several capsizes on this during this race already. They've had fairly strong weather, but it's all been in the right direction, and there's a lot of talk, even with still about 1,000 nautical miles to go, that unless something happens to the crew or the equipment on board, that we could see some new records being set.
Wait, which there's one going on right now?
So there's one going on at the moment. They're about 21, 22 days into their race. So they're probably about 7 to 10 days out of completing, those that are at the front. So
what are the records?
So the fastest solo crossing is 35 days.
35 days rowing from?
From La Gomera to,
wow,
to Antigua, which is amazing. And actually, Charlie Pritchard is the gentleman who's going to be building my boat.
Charlie, and he's doing it right now?
No, he's now in the boat building business and advising a lot of the crews. Over 50% of the boats in this year's race are built by his company, Rannoch.
What's his name?
Charlie Pitcher.
Okay.
Yeah, so he was a yachtsman, I think, first before he got into rowing. Did it the first time, and then I think it was on his second attempt. I think he's rowed it 3 or 4 times. But on his second attempt, he set that record.
Damn. Oh, he's the one who builds a boat, and he has the record for the fastest time?
Yeah.
Is he rooting against these people to break his record? I mean,
he's been very supportive. He's a great advocate for the sport, and his company does a number of other different endeavors. Like, he'll make special boats. So I think he's working with a team at the moment, a team of 4, that have got similar sort of boat design, but instead of oars, they've rigged like a pedalo. So they're going to pedal across the so he's making preparations for that. And then
you should make it look like a swan.
He's working with another guy that is actually going to do an unassisted round the world row, which has never been attempted before.
Going through what, Panama?
I'm not quite sure the route. It just got announced a couple of days ago, the actual boat design. So it's
where
that's kind of,
you can't go through the Cape of Good Hope, right? That's like, that's death for regular boats.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see the details when it comes out, but it's like rowing across the Atlantic, anywhere between. So I'm hoping for 50 days or less. That's what I've said. The last 2 years, the solo winners have come in around about 52 days. I think the longest crossing for a solo, I want to say 92, 97 days, and the longest crossing in this race, I think, is 112.
You're hoping to beat the winners of the last two?
Yes.
Wow.
But
good goal.
Who knows what happens? And the weather has the most kind of say in what's happening. This year, like I said, they've had very favorable following seas. It was very rough to begin with, but once they got into the main body of the race, the seas have just been propelling them really, really fast.
Oh, wow. Wait, have you done this before?
No.
So this will be your first try?
This is my first transatlantic crossing in a rowing boat.
Wow. Are you excited?
I am. You can tell. Once I start talking about it, I start to kind of get that nervous energy.
Yeah.
But not nervous in, oh, I don't want to do it, because if I felt like that, then I wouldn't do it. But yeah, it's going to be hard, but it's going to be... A lot of people say it's going to be life-changing.
Yeah, maybe.
And as a solo, it's so much more of a challenge than any of the other teams. Because even as a pair, while one person's sleeping, the other person's rowing. So you still got forward momentum.
Yeah, there's 1,000 questions.
As a solo, if the weather is against you, all you can really do is deploy what they call a sea anchor or a power anchor, which is like a big parachute that sits in the water to stop you getting blown backwards. And we did see in this race a couple of the solo rowers withdraw themselves because they got caught in an isolated weather system, and they were rowing for 10, 12 hours a day and making no headway. Every time they stopped, they're getting blown backwards and then getting capsized. So instead of risk damaging their boat or themselves, they pulled themselves out within the first week.
Damn, that must suck.
So, yeah, you're talking
that much preparation.
I've been preparing for about 8-10 months, and some of these other teams prepare for 2 or 3 years before they actually do the race. So imagine getting ready for 2 years and then a week in, having to pull yourself out because of the weather.
Oh, it's like the Olympics and pulling a hamstring.
Exactly.
Oh, so, my gosh. Wait, what's the longest you've gone solo?
I've never done
anything solo.
Never done this before. The most I did a couple of weeks before the holidays at my local gym, we did a 24-hour rowing race just on indoor erg.
Okay.
And we did it as teams of four, and that was enlightening, because again, you get to see, okay, now my appreciation of seat comfort has gone from fairly low in the preparation to top five, because if you can't sit down and you can't get on the oars, you're not going anywhere. So seat comfort, gearing up the boat to be efficient,
yeah,
is very important, because it's not, yes, there's some physicality about it. Rowing anything between 12 to 16 hours a day for 50 days is no mean feat, but it's more in your head. There's a certain amount of mental endurance and toughness that's going to be required.
That guy saying you should quit has to be getting stronger and stronger through that whole first week.
Exactly, and it doesn't matter how much you prepare yourself in terms of physical preparation and technical preparation and route planning and all those sort of things. You can't, when you get on the water, this boat all of a sudden is moving in every different direction. Seasickness is a big shock to a lot of people. And the culture of not being able to see land and not really be able to see a solid horizon for many days on end.
I went scuba diving in Timor-Leste, and the first couple of times was walk out onto a reef, and then the last time was just jump off a boat. Mm. And then, but it was just nothing. We had to swim to the reef, so I couldn't get my bearings around me, and I started freaking out because I was like, which way's land, which way's not? Yeah. And I just started hyperventilating. I had to go up.
Yeah, so.
It must be crazy.
That's where I feel I do have an advantage, because I was a British Royal Marine and then spent 10 years in the Special Boat Service. So it's kind of like your equivalent of a SEAL.
Okay.
So I spent most of my adult life, or my early adult life, either in, on, or under the water, in very similar sort of conditions. So I'm comfortable in that environment. I've always been somewhat of an introvert and a loner.
Yeah, what's the loneliness going to be like?
So that those are the things that some people have struggled with when doing my research and speaking to other rowers. That I feel that I'm okay. I've checked those boxes off.
What have they said about it?
It's a big shock. Even in this race, a couple of the guys that I've been following, they've struggled with homesickness and loneliness. And even as teams of four, they've struggled. You're normally working in shifts of 2 hours on, 2 hours off, and working as pairs in a four-person team. But at night, in pitch darkness, yes, you know that there's someone in front of you, but you may not necessarily be conversing with them, and you're just on the oars, and your mind will drift, and you start thinking of family back home and all that sort of stuff. So if you've never spent any time away from loved ones or even any other human contact, that is a culture shock.
Yeah, I mean, I'm an introvert too, pretty heavy one, but like after 4 or 5 days, you know, without like someone to talk to, I'll just talk to strangers.
Yeah,
you know, it's like I'll make do. I'm kind of interested in to see how that affects you after a while.
So it's there are a number of things that all come together, and some of that stuff you can't really fully prepare for.
Yeah, I mean, what are you going
to kind of jump in the deep end? Rowing, yes, I've got a friend of mine from many years ago who now coaches rowing at a university college in the UK. Water Rower have sponsored me, so I've now got a rowing machine at home that I can start to clock up the miles and build some rowing endurance. But it's still very different rowing even on a flat piece of water,
rowing
on an erg, to being on the ocean, because it's always pitching in different directions. So it's very different. And of course, you're not doing a 2,000 meter sprint. You're doing a 3,000 mile endurance event. So the cadence and stroke rate is a lot different. One oar might not be in the water all the time. So that stuff you can't really prepare too much. And there's a risk of overtraining on a rower.
Because then it's not a real situation.
Yeah, like I said, I very early on in my preparation, I was chatting to Mateo, who won the 2015 solo race. And he is an Italian, grew up on the lakes in Italy. His family business was working with boats. And he said, look, people will literally row 2 million miles in preparation, but it won't count really much because it's a very different experience. He said, you're better off cross-training, CrossFit, boxing,
really?
Things that will kind of beat you up and make you more mentally tough, as well as, yes, you've got to have some rowing. But it's more, I'm approaching in the sense of becoming injury-proof. So I want to have a very good technique to be efficient, and obviously being an older rower, I don't want to develop any injuries.
How old are you?
So
if you don't mind.
Just had a birthday now, so I'm now 47. So I'll be 48 when I actually do the row.
Okay. This will be next December?
This coming December? December 12th. And again,
into January.
Aiming for 50 days or less. So looking to end around about end of February.
End of February? Wow.
So, yeah, so cool. I'll start the race 47 and I'll finish the race 48.
Yeah, that'd be a nice birthday. Do you have like one candle on a like a donut or something?
So I'm I think I've got those kind of the physical aspects.
Yeah.
I'm comfortable, or certainly will be by the time we kind of November, December comes around.
Have people helped you with the type of training? Because I know, like, I have a friend who does a bunch of like treadmill running.
Mm-hmm.
He's a drunk fat man, per Kreischer, but then he actually tries real running, and
yeah.
He's like, oh, this is way different, you know? There's no, like, give.
So
is there, like, an actual regimen to, like...
That's the sort of the next phase that we'll enter into is I'm going to basically video my technique on the machine, send it to my friend. He's going to coach me from there. Atlanta Rowing Club, I'm going to work with them to and work on the technique and just build up some rowing time, whether it's on the water or on a machine. And then a guy that rode as a trio 2016, he still has a boat that's very similar to the boat that I'm having built.
Mm-hmm.
He's based down in Houston, and he's agreed to take me out on the water. So one of my disadvantages is that the boat is getting built in the UK. Obviously, I'm here.
So you can't oversee it?
Unless someone like Delta is going to sponsor me going back and forth every other month.
Yeah.
I'll have a limited amount of time in my own boat until kind of probably we're looking at March and May as the sort of the next two big times that I'll get time in my boat on the water, learning it inside out.
Ideally, you would have it here in Atlanta.
Yeah, that would be the perfect scenario is that. And a couple times a month, I could take it down to the coast and go up and down.
Take on the water.
And actually get out on the water. But there are many others that have not had a great deal of time on the boat and maybe not be as boat fit. But the boats have gotten so much better and so much more reliable. I think one of the biggest reasons why someone is withdraws from the race is because perhaps they didn't close the hatch or there's been some sort of water ingress that has messed up with the power system and they then lose power so they can't run their water maker and they can't run the navigation systems and they're kind of dead in the water.
Yeah.
So I will have a focused sort of week with the boat builders and the electricians, the engineers that put the systems in there. So
There's power in there?
Yeah.
Generator?
So, no, it's solar cells and, oh, okay. And batteries to store that when obviously the weather's not as good.
Okay.
So I've got to be kind of part endurance athlete, part ocean rower, and part MacGyver. So
when yeah.
do break or...
You got to fix it on the fly.
You got to fix things. You can only take so many spares. So you've got right. to be kind of... MacGyver and fix a lot of this stuff.
How do you keep... I'm trying to picture this boat in my head. How do you keep water from getting in and where... You're not sitting on top, right?
Yeah, so essentially you have a cabin at the front,
yeah.
which is about 6 feet, 6.5 feet, and it obviously tapers down to a nose. And then you have a smaller cabin, but it's not really a cabin that you'd put somebody in. That's where your batteries are, food, storage, equipment, some of the other bits and pieces that...
towards the back?
Yeah. So you have a sort of big cabin on the front, little cabin on the back.
And it's all enclosed?
Those two sections are. And yeah. then the deck in between is where the rowing station is, and that's all open to the elements.
That's open.
Yeah.
So what kind of elements are you expecting here? I mean, the rain and the waves?
It is, again, it can get up to 35, 40 knot winds, 40-foot waves.
Damn.
It can obviously get you're in the tropics, so obviously it can get up to, I know, 90-100 degree heat, rainstorms, squalls. Obviously some, I think it was in 2015 the last time, fairly early on in the race, they got hit with kind of an Atlantic storm, more mini sort of hurricane. It's so one of the reasons why you leave in sort of mid-December, because that's pre-Atlantic hurricane season.
Oh, really?
So the weather is a little bit more stable.
And you're leaving from far enough south where it's not...
Yeah,
it's not
kind of in relative terms, yeah. So
okay.
you asked earlier the kind of the two main routes, east to west, is kind of from North Africa, Canary Islands, to the Caribbean. And then the northern route will leave from New York... kind of the northeast, and then we'll come through either to Ireland or France that way. And obviously that can be a lot rougher, but that was the very first crossing by two Norwegians a couple hundred years ago that crossed from New York to
a couple hundred years ago.
Yeah, I can't remember the exact date now, but it was
they rode across.
Yeah.
Whoa, on like nothing technologically.
In an old school rowboat.
Wow, just switching off?
Yeah.
How long did it take them?
It was surprisingly fast. I think I want to say something like 67 days.
Because no sleeping, because everyone's always rowing.
They were kind of sleeping, but they completely different. You're talking woolen clothing, oilskins, canvas. And they didn't have like an enclosed cabin like we had. They basically, the front of the boat, they had some overhead cover, but it's just a canvas sheet. So they were wet the entire time.
How are you going to keep from your dome burning?
Sun hat.
Okay.
Lots of sunscreen.
Oh, yeah, lots of sunscreen.
So that's obviously
huh?
one of my things. I'm being a bit sort of follically challenged.
I like that term.
I've got to be careful not to get sunburnt.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh man! Oh man! I'm so excited just thinking about how cool this is going
to
be.
Yeah, it, like as you start to dig into it, it's amazing. So, one of the safety requirements of the race is that you have to have 90 days worth of food on board the boat, and 20% of that has to be meals ready to eat. So you don't have to rehydrate it, because most of the food, because of bulk and weight, is freeze dried. So that's why you need the water maker to reconstitute your food.
Oh.
Now,
well, like ramen?
Obviously, yeah.
Okay.
So, you'd be surprised some of the different menus that you can get. It's a lot different from camping kind of a few years ago. But so you have to prove that you have 90 days worth of rations. And one of the requirements prior to setting off is you obviously go through scrutineering, and every piece of safety equipment, every required piece of equipment has to be laid out in front of the boat, including your food. And you have to demonstrate you have 90 days worth. Now, you're looking at this race coming in, like, 30 days or so. I'm looking at 50 days. So why do I need all this extra food? And that's because you don't know what's going to happen out there. There's a safety requirement, but you have to demonstrate, okay, I am 230 pounds. I'm going to burn anywhere between 7 and 10,000 calories a day. So you have to kind of show that calorific amount of food.
Oh, wow.
Broken down in front of the boat.
So now, once you start, like high fat content.
Yeah, like people have played around with it. It's got to be palatable, because if you can't eat, then you're not going to maintain those sort of levels. But you, most people will drop 15-20% of their body weight.
15-20%
of the crossing. Yeah, so that's why a lot of people kind of bulk up and bring their body fat levels up prior to the race. It's quite funny. There was following one of the pairs team on this race the last week. I think they got some university out of the UK working with them, and they tested them just prior to starting the race, and their body fat percentages were like 15 and 17. They said, look, you need to bring that up. So they were like chowing down on a liter of ice cream every day leading up to the race.
Really?
Just trying to boost their fat levels to some extent. But yeah, so once you start, then if you think, all right, I'm gonna get there in 50 days, you can start dumping some of that food overboard.
Really?
To lighten the weight, because the lighter you are, then the easier you're going to be able to get through.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to carry that extra stuff.
But you obviously don't want to start dumping food too early on in the race, because you might need it.
Uh-huh.
That's part of the tactics involved.
Do you start drinking your emergency ration water when get like real close?
The water has to stay. So it's sealed.
Uh-huh.
So there's a race seal on it. And it's there purely as a safety requirement. Whereas the food is sort of, yes, there's a safety requirement in terms of the amount, but you're going to consume it. That water is kind of, everything else is broken, and it's going to keep you alive.
So now, even in the last, like, 2 days.
If you break a seal, then there's time penalties.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so there's no advantage in start getting, oh, we've got a week to go, let's start chugging this fresh water and really lighten the boat up. Because that is also acting as your ballast. So if you chug and get rid of all that weight, then the boat now is top heavy and is more prone to capsizing.
Oh.
Even when you had to break into your emergency water, you're then advised to fill it back up with salt water to maintain that ballast.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so there's some method in their madness in terms of how the boat is set up and why there are...
How much do these boats cost?
So... the newer boats, again, depends on what you put in it and what it's made of. So they can range from, on the low end, a second-hand reconditioned boat, just the boat itself, ready to row, 35,000 to about 50,000. And that's, again, varying depending on size, design, and the materials. Is it glass fiber or is it carbon fiber? And those sort of things. And then you have to have the equipment on board, from navigation systems, the radio, the water makers, that's kind of set. So all up, with everything ready to race, with the food and all that, you could be talking 80-odd thousand.
Damn. How are you going to pay for that?
Yeah, so
that's
through sponsorship.
Okay.
That's a lot of it. A lot of the other teams, and this is kind of, I don't know if I've set myself up just for a bigger challenge on the front end, they will normally enter into an agreement, a contract with some sort of charitable organization, and they'll say, look, we'll do a 60-40 split or a 50-50 split, that all the money comes into a pot. That money is used then to buy the boat, equip the boat, get ready for the race, and then the rest of the money goes to the charity. And that's how a lot of, certainly the UK and European teams have set up their campaigns, because not many people row across an ocean just for the hell of it. They want to do it for a reason, a cause, a charity of some sort. And that's what I've done. Now, what I've decided to do is sort of separate those two pots out. I'm going to have my sponsors and fundraising for the campaign, which is the boat, me, entry fees and all that sort of stuff, separate from any charitable donations. So somebody says, hey, Tim, love what you're doing, but I want my money to go directly to the campaign cause, the charities, then they can do that. I won't touch it. So I want kind of complete transparency between.
And so you're going to get all your money for the equipment just from sponsors? So
I'm pushing hard to raise money for the actual boat, and again, what I'm calling the campaign, getting me to the start line
as
kind of the Tame the Kraken campaign. And then my two charities, which I've split across either side of the Atlantic. Obviously, I'm UK born and bred, but now a US citizen. So I have Combat Stress is a an organization charity in the UK that deals with PTSD and mental health issues within the UK veteran community. And then on the U.S. side of things, there's an organization out of Dallas called 22 Kill.
22 Kill.
Which is the kind of the U.S. version. Now, there are a number of other U.S. organizations that also deal with PTSD and other sort of mental health issues. And within the last 3 or 4 years, we've seen a huge uptick in awareness, but it's still a long way to go.
Is that what's killing these guys? The PTSD?
Yeah, PTSD. And that tends to be a sort of catch-all statement sometimes. Some people have perhaps mental health issues that have been made worse when they've served and then come back and either fallen on hard times or they're dealing with their demons. Or it's been brought upon by what they've seen, what they've done. When serving overseas,
do you think it's? I'm not sure. I haven't seen the stats, but has it gotten higher since we've been, at least in the U.S., at a constant state of war for the last 15 years?
I would say yes, because obviously we're now in the longest serving war that the U.S. has been involved in. So just through sheer volume,
everyone coming out of that has seen action.
You'd expect that, but again, you're looking at a lot of. I think the biggest group, and again, I don't have the newest numbers that have just been released late last year, I think it was September, the biggest band of those that have taken their own lives are kind of the, I think, 35 to 45 range. Huh. And some of these folks that are taking their lives are, again, not just veterans from more recent wars and conflicts. These are sort of Vietnam vets and others that to some degree have been sort of forgotten. And again, it's that pot of money, that support that's been there has been spread so thin because of more recent conflicts and wars. And I think there wasn't enough data or awareness around the problem. And I think that's what we've seen, certainly a year after the initial report that came up with the 22 figure, 22 veterans a day being taking their own lives, to the following year, more details, more data. Now we're seeing larger organizations working with large kind of academic institutions here in the U.S. to dive deeper into this. I think just last week, Bristol-Myers Squibb teamed up with University of Alabama. And they've actually called it Operation Deep Dive, and they want to drill down into kind of the root causes, and can they now start to preempt those individuals or groups that are more likely to suffer and potentially take their own lives. So we're now starting to see a lot more data around the problem, and maybe that will lead to some sort of positive intervention.
Yeah. What does awareness do? I always, whenever people try to raise awareness, I'm always a little leery of that, because I'm like, what's the actionable?
And that's the thing, it's you can't have one without the other. I think you've got to get to that tipping point where, and I, even myself, I have to admit, like coming into this, did a 22 push-up challenge. Because I've moved here, I'd lost contact with a lot of my old military buddies, and I haven't been back for a reunion for a number of years. So when someone close to me, and again, you're still talking, there was a 10, 15-year gap from the last time I spoke to Buff, that he learning that he had taken his life within a month of us reconnecting and chatting through some old times, kind of hit it home. And since starting this campaign and starting to have my own sort of awareness campaign go out there, and primarily to raise sort of funds to get this up and going, I've had people come in and say, really support what you're doing. By the way, my son suffers from this, or my brother's son took his own life. So it's surprising how, again, a couple of people removed from yourself, that it's touched a lot more people than one would normally think.
22 a day.
So yeah, I think those numbers have improved slightly. I think they say it's around about 20 a day now are still taking their lives, but that's still a very, very high number.
I know they were trying to combat the stat, and they were saying that it's like, we look at the general population and how many servicemen there are, and that's about similar, but I still think it's way higher, right?
It was, and it was that sort of catch-all statement and number, but they didn't really know how to break that down. But this latest report that's come out, they've gone on and they're looking at state by state. They're looking male veterans and female veterans, because again, they felt that this was a male issue more so. But there are female vets that are equally suffering from PTSD or other health, mental health issues. So I think we're now starting to see that granular detail come through, and then with the right support, they can start to look at again predictive analysis as to, okay, why is this happening in this group, and at what point can we intervene, and what other support systems can we put in place? Can we, again, around that awareness campaign, a lot of the time it's just being able to sit down and talk to someone, coaching for friends and families, and all the other sort of support mechanisms that I think have been lacking in the past.
Actually talking through something.
Yeah, some pain. To sit down and chat it through and talk through and just to be there. And like that's even happened to me, someone I don't even know, through someone that I used to work with at CNN when we went off doing a lot of kind of conflict journalism stuff. She was involved with someone, pushed out the word about the campaign, and then someone contacted me directly through social media and said, I was thinking about taking my life when this came across. Now, I don't think I had any direct intervention in to say, oh, don't do that, but it was enough to pull him back from the edge.
Wow.
I pushed that through to the person that again was the mutual friend, and I think they've stepped in and they're talking about it now.
Is there maybe it's all men, but I'm guessing more like military sort of a feeling of like, I don't want to talk about this?
Yeah, there is that sort of bravado. Oh, I'm supposed to be all big and tough. I can't let something like feelings or mental health get in the way. So yeah, that has been an issue, I think, in the past.
Yeah.
It is tough for anyone really to talk about it and say, hey, I've got a problem. I don't think that's exclusive to the military, but I think it is it has been a bigger challenge in the past to broach it.
To actually go to support groups.
But I think, again, around that awareness, we're seeing opportunities for people to talk through these things. And I think you could say that's reflective of how things have progressed within just being able to move around a lot quicker, whether it's to and from a business meeting in Europe or to and from a conflict in the Middle East. Gone are the days where, after experiencing war or conflict, you would then come back to a base, get on board a ship, and then you'd have that kind of period of decompression, chatting through your experiences with your comrades.
You mean on the way home?
On the way home.
Oh, yeah.
Now, don't get that. You weeks. Literally, you get your papers, you jump on a plane, and within 24 hours, you're back home.
Oh,
so
wow.
So you haven't had that ability to sort of decompress.
Yeah, if you were stationed in the Philippines in World War II, you're taking a long time to get home.
You've had time through going through that logistics chain, that transport chain back. It could be several days or a number of weeks before you get back home. And at every stage, you've probably cleansed yourself to some extent by just talking through these experiences with your fellow soldiers that have also experienced the same. So it's not like coming back and sitting down in front of a psychologist and talking through, oh, I've got some problems, because there's not that ability to relate. Whereas if you've, again, been in a foxhole with somebody across there, and now you're sharing a beer or a coffee and talking through, it helps you process it. So I think that's one of the things that a lot of people are now starting to see, that the speed in which you return back to normal, again, it's that culture shock.
Yeah.
And it takes time to sort of adjust.
Even just being somewhere else in the Middle East or anywhere where it's like,
Yeah, that again, that's part of what I do today. I'm deal with travel security and travel safety. And again, it's that culture shock. You're going to another country. There are things that, there's not a bad guy behind every tree or bush that's going to jump out at you. It's really, you put yourself in circumstances because you're not attuned to the environment that you're going to.
Right.
So
yeah, I spent like a few months in Asia, and then just coming home, that first like couple days, it was just like, I don't know how to do this. Yeah. I remember going, just coming off the metro to see my parents and like not being able to go to their house for like an hour.
Yeah.
And like, I don't know if I'm ready, but I can't imagine like having to be a war and coming back to that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, and again, I spent 12 and a half years in the military in different circumstances from what a lot of the, soldiers that are experiencing today, but yeah, that there is a big difference in terms of how you are when you're over there to how you are over here with your family.
Yeah,
and that's sometimes
where socially
communications can sort of break down.
Did you ever deal with any of this?
Yeah, I always had to have about 3 days worth of sort of decompression before I again my senses would sort of come down to a more normal layer. I can remember one experience when I'd come home from being somewhere, and again it wasn't anything too crazy, and I think it was a friend's birthday or something, and we'd gone out, and I instinctively my back against the wall, I could see the exits. I was a little bit more hyperactive. And my friend of mine was talking to a girl, and she went off to the bar or the bathroom or something like that, and came back. She said, she thought you were on like speed or something
because your eyes are darting everywhere.
You're just hyper aware of what was going on around you. And I over the year has learned that if I did go away to some of these scarier places, it would take me about 2-3 days to come back to any sense of normality.
Wow. I know a lot of Italian Americans who all like would love to have been in the mafia, but they aren't and never were, and they always say like, I never sit with my back to the door because you never come in. And I'm like, dude, that's never affected you in your life. What are you talking about?
When I first started dating my wife, we'd go into a restaurant, and she'd say, where do you want to sit?
Really?
She'd know if I did sit where I would not normally sit, that I'd be anxious, I would not be comfortable, I would not be engaged in the conversation as I should be,
because your head would be moving around like you're watching a game on a TV.
So she would say where do you want to sit, and then she would sit opposite.
Oh, that's weird. That's cool though. Okay, so how can people donate to these charities, by the way, before we get back to this boat stuff? Combat Stress and 22 Kill.
Well, at the moment,
or should we go through you?
You can go directly to either of those organizations, 22kill.com, and they have their own funding page up, and you can donate directly to them. Same with Combat Stress, if anyone is listening into this in the UK. I hope by the end of, I'd say the end of this month, hopefully by the end of January, I will have funding pages set up with each of those organizations with links through the actual website. If you go to my website, which is tamethekraken.com.
Okay. I'll wait till you have all those stuff up before.
There are also links on the website that will direct you to the two charities. So it's easy. Just go to tamethekraken.com and then go to the the challenge page, and you'll see there's links already set up to the two charities, and it tells you a little bit more about what they are and who they support.
And then we can give through your endeavor.
Yeah,
to
on the top and bottom of each of the pages, there's a donate button, either through PayPal or credit card, and that will go to the actual campaign. So that may, depending on how much you want to donate, you could feed meat for a day. You could buy an important piece of safety equipment.
Oh, so they can donate to the campaign or to the charity?
Or the charities.
Oh,
exactly.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, they could, is you make it like a registry, like a wedding registry, where it's like,
so, yeah,
I will
so obviously
get you
it comes through.
One box of ramen.
So the next phase is when we get the funding pages or links set up, we're then going to set up kind of either a scrolling part on the, so anyone that has donated to the actual campaign,
mm-hmm.
for whether it's for themselves, whether it's for maybe someone they've loved, they can dedicate their donation to someone. We'll have that up on the page, so you'll see not how much they've donated, but Bob Smith is donating X for this reason, and that'll be up there. And the hope is when we get to the actual putting all the sponsors and stuff up on the boat, that there'll be somewhere on the hull, whether it's inside the cabin or somewhere, where we'll have everyone's name that's donated.
Oh, really?
On the boat as well.
Oh, that's cool.
So, yeah.
So they can sort of be part of the voyage.
They can be part of the experience as well.
Oh, that's really neat.
Yeah.
That's really neat. How are you doing for sponsors right now?
So, we're where we wanted to be. So, yeah. we're still a long way to go. I don't expect us to be 100% funded until perhaps midway through this year anyway. Some of the big ticket items in terms of like shipping the boat from the UK to La Gomera and then from Antigua back to the US, obviously that's a big lump of cash.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping to reach out to some international shipping companies, FedEx, UPS, anyone of that sort of stature that may donate kind of goods in kind.
Their experience, yeah. Oh,
airline,
that'd be great.
Flights back and forth, again, that's another big.
Yeah, come
aspect.
On, Delta, step
so
up.
I'm obviously going to start leaning on our friends at Delta, being the hometown airline
from
here,
Atlanta.
And see if they will get me to the UK and back a few times just to get the boat built.
Yeah, make it and up then, to me through Tim for canceling Monroe's flight today from New York. I have no one to open for me.
And then I'm going to keep sort of whittling away. I initially approached this as thinking, right, these big companies, they'll be a great cause, they'll step up. And while it's been disappointing for me because they've said, great idea, but it's not aligned with what we're doing, but we're doing this. It's been enlightening that there is so much good going on, and they are sort of supporting a lot of other good charities, as well as other veteran sort of based sort of needs. So that's been educating and encouraging. So we just keep whittling away. And then I'm starting to look at this now as this is going to happen. And
yeah,
I am going to get across the Atlantic Ocean by myself.
Damn.
I hope to do it at the front of the pack, if not win the race as a solo. So why not spread that kind of that winning kind of noise with a lot of smaller companies? Because I can get to my funding targets through smaller organizations donating $500, $1,000. And then when I win and have all this media attention come through, they'll benefit as well.
Probably, oh, right.
Probably more so than a Delta or a UPS or whoever.
Which already has notoriety.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's where I'm going to focus my efforts now, is to try to have more people on the team, more smaller sponsors, that when it all comes good in 12 months' time, that they'll benefit probably a lot greater than their initial donation.
Yeah, and karmically, you have more people rooting for you.
Yeah, all that support that's going to help me get across.
You won't be able to talk to anyone or call home or anything like that. Is there anything on there?
Yeah, so obviously there are different systems on board. You've got to have a satellite phone that the race organizers give you for twice daily check-ins. So that's a race requirement from a safety perspective.
And you do that locally?
Yeah, so you have a satellite phone for that. Then I'll have another satellite phone, which will be more for me dealing with my race support, weather routing, and talking to people that want to have a chat. And then through that same system, you can receive like text messages and emails. So the idea, having worked with the media for nearly 15 years now, I'm going to start calling in favors, and I want to try and have more communication capability than one would normally go for. So I can provide more content. And I got a few other little ideas up my sleeve that will help provide more unique content.
What are you going to do? Because you can't be typing while you're rowing.
No. There'll be some probably creative use of the old stylus pen and some sort of tablet device to help with that. Video postcards.
Can you make videos?
I'm going to do little video
postcards. That's going to be so cool.
And then try and have some other interesting sort of takes on the video content that I send back.
Yeah,
and that's been fairly interesting. There's an Irish rower in this race. He's a former Irish rugby player. He's done a number of other endurance events, and he has a BGAN system on board, which gives him more ability to transmit. And he's been providing fairly regular video updates.
Really?
It has drawn a lot of attention.
What's his name? I'll look up to see his followers. So he's in this race right now?
So yeah, his boat is Gulliver's Travels.
Okay.
And Damien Brown is his name. Yeah, so he's provided some interesting sort of content. He got hit hard with seasickness early on in the race, and everyone was like, because he's obviously a big giant of a man, was expecting more from him. And when he wasn't moving, they were like getting concerned, and he was suffering really bad from blisters and seasickness in the first 24, 48 hours. He got over that, and then last week, I think it was, he got hit with a freak wave when he was in the cabin asleep, bounced off the cabin. He's there on camera and he's got blood streaming like down his face or dried to his face.
It's like, hi guys.
Yeah, and he's smiling through it all, getting on with it. So he's I think become a bit of a race sensation.
Hero, right?
Yeah. And then there's another solo rower who nobody's heard anything from him. He's either a New Zealander or he's an expat of some sort. He now lives in Netherlands. He may have some Danish or Dutch blood in him. But he's just got knocked back to fourth in the overall race. So he's number one in the solo race, but he's fourth overall.
Whoa.
And he was
number one overall.
So he's still number one in the solo class.
Jesus.
But he is fourth overall out of all the boats. So he is holding his own with the other three teams of four.
Wow.
And that's
nuts.
And I mean, everyone's gone like, how can he sustain that level of effort for the amount of time
far in are they now?
So I think he's just crossed into the last 1,000 miles to go. So everyone's looking at him to think, can he break
this record?
That record of 35 days.
And is he able to do that? Well, I mean, I'm sure, one, from training and stuff, but two, is it just like patterns and wave patterns?
He's a big 6'7" Dutch guy. He has sailed, so he's a yachtsman, so he sailed around the world a couple of times, if not three times, one of which I think has been the solo. So again, he's used to being by himself, he's used to kind of long hours, that sleep deprivation, culture shock. Being a big guy, he's certainly got the physical stature. But I think everyone has been amazed that he's been able to sustain his work effort and the speeds that he has for as long as he's had. Everyone's looking at him. His name's Mark Slatz. So yeah, he's only just been pushed into fourth place because he was up there with the first two teams since the race started.
Do you think there's a wall that, that comes?
If it has, he's smashed right through it.
Wow, yeah.
You know, he's been able to sustain this now for 21 days.
Jesus, that's crazy.
Yeah, so who knows, being Dutch, he might have some other...
And he's in the last third right now?
So he, I think within the last 24 hours, he just got knocked into fourth place. But yeah. The second solo rower is hundreds of miles behind him.
Really?
Like he could probably take a week off and still come in first.
There's this Moab race in the Utah desert, just a foot race. I think it's like 250 miles, something like that. And a woman won, and she was days ahead of the next guy. Like, not even like a little bit, but like far, far away.
Yeah, like I said, there with all these endurance events, there's a certain amount of physical aspect to it. But again, it just shows you how much mental robustness you need for these sort of events.
Yeah. Dude, I can't even... I mean, when I run just to jog after 10 minutes, it's like, just take a minute off now. Just, you can walk this one. I don't know how you keep doing that.
Yeah, so it's... And I think that was somewhat of a wake-up call. I was surprised how initially tough that 24-hour row was. Now, granted... We're rowing at a quicker pace. We didn't set any records by any stretch, but it was the sleep deprivation.
Even to go that sleep after 16, 17, 18 hours, you start to get like...
So I think after, during the whole 24 hours, I think I must have slept probably 3 hours or less. And that's the bit that drains you because your brain just doesn't function.
I did it's not quite the same, but did a bunch of MDMA and mushrooms, and then couldn't sleep the next day. And by the night after that, talking to my girlfriend, she was just like, "What did you? I don't understand what you just said." Like over and over again, just like, "I don't get. You didn't make any sense."
Yeah,
and that's one day off of sleep.
Yeah. Well, again, that's why sleep deprivation is such a effective torture method, interrogation method. Because you can't control it. Like with a certain amount of tolerance for pain, or at some point you'll black out because the pain's that bad. But sleep deprivation, that's a whole...
It's crazy what it does to you when you're just like, I'm sorry, I'm not, can't, I can't.
Our coach at the gym, he worked out and taught class before the row. Then he did the row and it was like he was drunk.
Really?
Yeah, he struggled to string like two sentences together.
It's kind of funny.
But he was videoing himself as well. He was giving updates to kind of the Facebook group, and everyone was going, "What is he on?"
He's on nothing. That's a problem.
Exactly. He was on lack of sleep.
Yeah. So when you do sleep during this Talisker, what are they calling it?
The Talisker Atlantic Whiskey Challenge.
Do you bring Talisker with you?
Talisker do give you a little gift set of whiskey for your voyage.
Yeah, Talisker is pretty good whiskey.
I've never tasted it myself.
Oh, really?
I haven't had a chance yet, so I'm looking forward to. I'm not much of a whiskey man. I'm more of a sort of any other fan.
Yeah,
rum, tequila, but I've heard good things.
Oh, I love Scotch, man. That's my favorite.
So they give us a little sample to celebrate the holidays as we cross.
Oh, you'll be there during Christmas.
Yeah, so during
New Year's.
Yeah, so there for Christmas and New Year's and my birthday, obviously.
That sounds so sad to be like, Merry Christmas, one shot, and then right back to rowing.
So I can't remember what we asked.
Not if you bring alcohol on board with you. Sleeping.
Sleeping. Yes. Yeah. So that's something that obviously. Other than a solo, all the others tend to work in two-hour shifts, so 2 hours on, 2 hours off. And then within that 2 hours off, you're not just sleeping. You have to, like, clean yourself, prepare your food, do any other sort of maintenance that needs to be done, like get all your normal sort of housekeeping stuff. So you may only get an hour and a half sleep per block. A number of the solo teams coming into this race were going to approach things differently. They were going to row a lot longer during the day and then take a six-hour block at night, which, to me, doesn't make that much sense because
to rejuvenate and sleep.
Because at night it's going to be cooler and more comfortable to row.
Like in the desert, they tell you to walk at night.
Safer. So I'll be interesting to sort of speak to some of the teams on what sort of routine they did work with and what worked for them.
Yeah.
And then sort of compared that to what Mark Slatt has been doing, because maybe he's just been row when you can row, sleep when you need to sleep, eat when you can eat. Because that was some of the advice that was given to me by Matteo and some of the other folks that have already rowed. It's like, yeah, if you're feeling good, keep rowing. If you know you've got weather coming, row into the weather, because you know you're going to have to deploy the power anchor and get some forced rest because you can't do anything else. So you may have a strategy going in, but then the daily tactics will be very much dependent on A, how you feel, what the boat's doing, what the weather's doing. So you may think, right, I'm going to row for 12 hours and then sleep for 6 and then row for 12 and sleep for 6. But you may row for 8, get hit by weather, and then you could be stuck in the cabin for a day and a half.
Right, without the ability to sleep, because you just slept for 5.5 hours, 6 hours.
Yeah, well, without the ability to row, so it's going to reset and mess with your routine straight away. So, I've started to consider that, but there are a lot of other things to get figured out before figuring out how much sleep I need.
And that's really strategy, not preparation.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Again, you can't really prepare yourself for sleep deprivation, and then I've done enough of that over my adult life. That will be kind of listening to my body and figuring out what the weather's doing and then kind of come out with a plan that suits that period of time.
Yeah. Do you have satellites for the weather and how to get around weather or just go through it?
Again, part of the communication is that it'll get sent to you in a either an email or a bulletin or text of some sort. You'll have access to that through your radios if you've got that sort of stuff, or you can pick up the phone and speak to either the duty officer or your own team.
Mm-hmm.
I've just started chatting to the Weather Channel here now in Atlanta to see if they want to do some quid pro quo in terms of I provide you with content and a great story, root for the hometown boy. You give me
the weather channels here.
You give me weather information. Yeah.
Oh, that'd be great.
So
that'd be
great. I'm hoping that they'll come on board, and I've got a couple of friends that now work there. So if they sign up and go, yeah, then hopefully I'll have
Tim in this.
Some better weather information going in, and then daily updates as we progress.
Do you try to go around the weather, or do you just like hunker down?
Depends on what it is. Obviously, if it's a slow moving system and you're on one of the peripheral edges, then yes, you could alter your track to some extent and miss the worst of it.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it's not like, oh, storm coming, let me bang out 90 degrees in that direction and box around it, because that will just add too much time. Depending on how bad it is it following you, is it against you? It may be better off just rowing hard into it, deploy the power anchor, wait for it to blow over you,
and then get going again.
And then get back on the oars as soon as you can afterwards.
Must be hard to sleep while those waves are crashing and bouncing up and down.
And that's one of the things, is how you pack that cabin. And some people have literally kind of strapped themselves in.
Yeah, would that work? So then you're staying in the bed?
So if you get rolled, you're not going to be banging off the roof and so forth. Others have kind of wedged themselves in with either their clothing bags or little beanbaggy type things. It all depends on you don't want any weight on board that is not going to provide you with some assistance. So it's not like, oh, let me have five pillows, because it's just extra weight for real kind of benefit. So you're sort of limited to some extent, but I think maybe like a little seatbelt thing just to keep you attached to the boat before you roll.
Yeah.
And maybe some sort of lightweight beanbag pillow to stop getting your head banged off the roof.
Yeah. On days when there's no bad weather, what are the waves like?
So again, Mid-Atlantic, you will always have, even on a calm day, kind of, you could have a 2 to 3 meter swell.
2 to 3 meter.
So again, but it's going to be a nice rolling sort of thing. It's not a wave that has a face to it and a lip. So you'll just kind of bob over those. Or in very calm conditions, it's flat as a mill pond. But then there's no wind, so the only form of forward momentum you have is what you put into it. The reason why these guys and girls are moving so fast in this race at the moment is that they have strong winds that are all following. So they're basically surfing down.
Is that just lucky?
Yeah, they're all pointing in the right direction.
Wow!
I think these are ideal conditions. You couldn't have got anything better.
When you get those, I guess they're, what are they called? Not tailwinds. Is it tailwinds?
Yeah.
Tailwinds. Is it just row as much as you can while you get those?
Yeah.
Or is it
depends,
like,
on the boat. So the shorter boats and those that are, so one of the big differences between glass fiber and carbon fiber is, yes, there's a little bit of weight difference, but carbon fiber is more rigid. So as you come down the wave and eventually you hit the trough, so instead of like sort of sinking into that trough, the boat flexing and kind of almost coming to a dead stop, and then you've got to build up momentum again to climb up the next wave.
Jeez.
You tend to surf better. So
on what? With what?
So the just like a surfboard.
With carbon?
Yeah. So it surfs down the wave, and you tend to sort of bounce out of the trough a little bit more. So it's a bit more rigid, could be a little bit more uncomfortable, but it's there's a more efficient use of the energy that's generated. And you can, like I said, get up to some fairly fast speeds surfing down these waves.
Oh, just like going down and shooting up. Like, what are you using? Carbon fiber?
So I'm going for the carbon fiber, more for that rigid, better efficient kind of energy transfer.
Why would someone go for the glass fiber?
Cost.
Oh.
Yeah.
It's way cheaper.
It's 7 to 10 grand difference in materials.
Damn. For such a long trip, though, it's like...
Yeah.
It's hard to skimp, but I'm sure you want to in places.
Other than what has to be on there from a race perspective, I'll probably go fairly Spartan in terms of creature comforts, and save on the weight. And then once we get into the thick of it, then I would probably be looking to jettison as much of the food weight, add the extra food weight as possible. And I'm hopefully going to be working here with Kennesaw University, going through some physical testing to work out kind of exactly what my calorific burn rate is, what my recovery rates are, become somewhat of a lab rat for them. So I'll have more data on me as a physical specimen going in, so I can perhaps be a little bit more scientific as to, right, like, just go with this, and I'll probably limit types of food so there's less variety, because it's 50 days or less. I can suffer through that. I want to get from A to B shortest and quickest.
Doesn't Lance Armstrong live out here? I should talk to him.
I'm not sure if he does. Isn't he
somewhere in the south?
I'm not sure. Maybe he is.
Probably not the regimen you want.
Probably not.
Wow, it's so fucking exciting, man. How do you do when you jettison food? Like, what do you do with the packaging?
So yeah, you have to keep all the wrappers, because again, at the end of the race, you get scrutineering on the back end as well, and they make sure that you haven't touched any of your water, and all of the equipment that you started the race is still on board. So even if something breaks, you can't,
because they don't want you littering anything,
because you don't want to obviously pollute the seats. All of your food wrappers. So yeah, you have a Snickers bar. Goes back into the so you have like a designated refuse container storage area on the boat, so everything goes into there, and then that gets kind of checked off when you get to Antigua.
Okay. Do you wash yourself, like, how?
So
you don't use deodorant, right?
A lot of the rowers typically will row naked.
Really? What?
If the weather's obviously warm enough, because even with just thin lycra, one cotton layer on, whatever your choice of clothing is, you will get hit with a wave, and then if it dries out, the salt crystals then become an abrasive. So you can imagine rowing all day long and you've got something rubbing up against you, you can have a lot of problems with salt sores and abrasions
that then can
become infected, and that's another reason why people can get pulled out. So a lot of people will row naked, and then at the end of their shift will typically use like baby wipes or some sort of wipes to get the salt
head
off
to toe.
And that's kind of their the hygiene regiment.
You got at least wipe your ass.
Yeah. Salt sores on your ass is going to be again, it's that comfort factor.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Chafing, all those sort of things are real world issues.
Are you going to row naked?
I have no problem with being naked, so more than likely that if that's the suggested way to go.
Oh, that'd be fun. I have no problem with that either. I would love that, actually.
Obviously, then there's less need for taking spare sets of clothing on board as well. And then, yes, you have wet weather gear if the weather turns bad and you do need protection from the elements.
If it gets cold.
It shouldn't get that cold. Yes, you're wet. The wind gets up. There is going to be that wind chill.
What, down to like 20 or 15?
No, it's not going to get that cold. But it will still be a cooling effect on the body. So you need to sort of protect yourself against that. I think there's more of a concern through like heat and dehydration is a bigger threat than hypothermia and anything sort of cold on the southern route.
Yeah.
But some people have also had, they've had spare fresh water, and they've rigged up a solar shower.
The shower, really?
And they've had a fresh water shower just to get the salt off. I don't have to really worry about washing my hair, so that's, again, another concern that's been sort of taken off the table.
Are you going to shave the back of your head?
No, probably not, because, again, you get a shaving nick or you get an ingrowing hair gets infected. So typically, most of the guys don't shave, and there's some impressive beards that come out the other end.
I bet. Yeah. 2 months of just everything.
If you go to the actual Atlantic Campaigns or the Talisker Whiskey Challenge website and go to some of the pictures and race archives, they have like
before and after.
I think his name's Paul Duffy, the kind of race photographer, and he always takes a before and after picture, and you see some fantastic beards.
Yeah, red faces and beards,
like sunken faces from over the weight that they've lost, and like weathered, like salty sea dog type after picture.
Lost 40 pounds, again 3 pounds of beard weight.
There you go. Yeah, like things living in it. So yeah, I anticipate having a more disheveled look when I arrive in Antigua.
Yeah, I'm sure. It'd be cool to see. Is there, how do you take dumps? Like, where do you take shit?
Bucket and chuck it.
Really?
Yeah, so.
Is there something set up to, like, an easier?
Again, some people will rig, like, a toilet seat to go on the bucket that actually, in, like, these preparedness type websites bucket and stores, and you can get these portable toilets with seats on it, but really it's for 2 or 3 minutes of comfort. It's added weight, and because you can't really use it for anything else.
Yeah.
Whereas you can use the bucket for like bailing out or doing other maintenance jobs on board. So yeah, you have to have a couple of buckets, and really you do your business and cast it overboard.
Whoa. Yeah, that must be. I mean, whatever, you gotta.
Yeah.
You gotta. Do you, how did you get started with, like, adventuring in general?
I would say it's probably come from my father. The family business started by my grandfather has been coaching travel business. So I've always traveled, even as a very young child. And by the time I was a teenager, I'd practically been to every country in Europe.
Really?
Just my mother worked. My father worked driving the coaches. What are you going to do with me? I would go along and
that's great.
Load the cases up, load the cases off, and hand out the teas and coffees on board the coach. So I was very lucky to have traveled extensively sort of growing up. And then I joined the military, so continued to travel. And then when I left the military, not knowing really what I wanted to do, the natural progression is to go into sort of security. But only a couple of months after leaving the military, did some work with the BBC and went to Brazil and did an investigative piece on the Mahogany Mafia, and kind of then embarked on working with kind of frontline journalists, mainly conflict journalists, for the last 14 years or so. So uh-huh. I've always been traveled in providing support to journalists in that sense.
Isn't it great going to another country and just when you land, you just
is.
Like,
it's that feeling. I've always enjoyed travel. I'm, like I said, I'm comfortable pretty much anywhere I've gone. Obviously, I have a unique set of sort of skills and I can attune myself to that environment. Again, just and my father always used to be very adventurous in terms of trying new food. You go somewhere, try the food.
Yeah, right? Of course. Like, that's like the best part.
And yeah, so that I've just grown up with it. And I think the military just extended that in a different direction. And even since leaving the military, I think with working with journalists has also taken me to equally exciting and challenging places.
Are you a restaurant guy or a street meat guy?
Street meat, probably.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Yeah, me too.
I can remember the first Gulf War, landing in Turkey and heading out to where we were going to cross over. And there was a street vendor there, and he's grilling up some meat.
Yeah. It's just like, I don't know.
Yeah, I'll try something with that. And everyone's going, wee. And it was cooked all the way through. Again, it was probably overcooked. And like, anything that is in it would have been killed.
Right.
So, yeah. And I've only ever fallen foul probably twice in my entire life and had a bad
really
reaction to anything.
We had this idea that once you get food sickness, food poisoning, you're immune. for at least a couple of years.
Well, I think there's over 130 some odd different types of salmonella, so I don't think you'd be immune to all of them.
Well, I'd like to believe that. Yeah. That's it keeps us going.
But yeah, I think it's the risks are nowhere near the kind of the benefits from like diving into a culture.
Yeah.
And the food is such a big part of a culture.
Yeah.
To go somewhere and say, oh, where's the nearest kind of fast food joint that you're used to? Well, no, like, try new food, try different cuisines. And
dude, I was in Thailand, which is barely not Western anymore, but yeah. My friends there were like, let's go to Burger King. And I was like, stop it. No, not this is not allowed. Stop it.
Yeah, no. I've got to be in a dire situation to go to Burger King or any fast food place here.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'm like, you guys wouldn't even do that in America. Why suddenly are you now doing that at a point where you get cow's leg chicken?
Yeah, but it's the familiar, isn't it?
Oh.
Like, that's I think that's the part.
If you live there, maybe after a year, I could see that.
Yeah, I don't know.
All my expat friends in Shanghai, they were like, eventually, at first, they were first like 6 months a year, they were like, let's try everything we can. And then it became like, where's a burger? Where's pizza?
It's funny. I the last overseas trip that I had with a client, we were flying out to the Philippines, and we stopped off in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
And she had to go to this particular lounge on a particular gate because they had a particular burger that she would always eat, because she wasn't all that keen on Asian food. So that would kind of tide her over for the 2 or 3 days that she would be...
really? Gone?
In Manila or Jakarta or wherever it would be connecting through. And coming out, actually, I shared... there's got to be something about this burger, and I had it. And actually, it wasn't too bad.
yeah.
It was a good burger.
I mean, a burger's fine once in a while, yeah. But I mean, come on, you can get it anywhere. But,
yeah, I'm a big fan of Thai food, so...
yeah, that southern Thai food, too, is so spicy. Mm.
Oh, yeah.
But even that cow soy from the north, I mean, I love it, man. It's so good.
Yeah.
It's so good.
And
the papaya salads and the...
the blend of flavors. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very creative. It
might be the most flavorful food in the world, Tom.
I went out and spoke at a conference in Kuala Lumpur, mm-hmm. and the hotel we're staying at, every Thursday, they would invite street hawkers into the kind of the general restaurant and set them up with like a real grill and a real all the other things, and they would bring their best street food into the restaurant.
That's fantastic. Cool.
Yeah,
and that's just, even better, because then you're not getting the aluminum scrapings off their pans they've been using for 30 years.
It's fresh.
Yeah,
they have hygiene standards, and I thought, what a brilliant idea.
Yeah,
and you could also go on street hawker tours and give them sample.
Oh, really?
Which I thought was great. I wasn't there long enough to do one of those, but I think that would definitely be on the list if I went back that way.
I knew a guy in Cambodia who's a comedian in Hong Kong, but he moved to Cambodia, and he's a chef, and he gave street hawker tours.
I do.
Of Cambodian food and just different flavors, and he like already knows a few restaurants and street places that are like, come on, a grip of whites, we'll show you what we got.
Great,
it was tremendous. Do people try to dissuade you from doing this? Loved ones and friends?
Obviously, my mother knows me. And like, I went through a phase of when, certainly working in Iraq and Afghanistan and a few other places, that I wouldn't tell her where I was going or what I was doing until I perhaps got back, because she would worry. And she has asked, like, why?
Yeah.
And then when I've explained kind of why, now she's somewhat on board or has accepted that I'm going to be doing it. And my wife has a couple of times said, I don't know why I agreed to this. but has also accepted that, well, at least no one's going to be shooting at you.
Yeah, it's got to.
So it's, while there
it's
is
be better
a
than
level
what
of
with it before.
Sort of danger, it's not as bad as some of the other places I've been and stuff that I've done.
Yeah. Sometimes when I'm traveling, I imagine my mom seeing me and just like, no, that is not, no, you cannot get on the back of that. No, you cannot.
Yeah. Well, still, statistically, you're more likely to be involved in a road traffic accident and get killed in a car accident of some sort than being kidnapped. Shot at. So
exactly.
Again, we all get conditioned into, I'm going to this place, something bad's going to befall me, but no, you'll then go and jump on the back of a moped or in the back of some rickshaw or tap-tap, and it's, again, that's, you're putting your life in someone else's hands.
I mean, there's no seatbelts, but who cares? Yeah. It's like short term. I mean, it's not North Korea. You know, it's
there,
like, free the travel advisories. If it's not bad, then it's not bad. Then it's just like your own version of like fear. That's what I always think. Yeah.
And again, it's the old to the British parachute school in the military.
You're a paratrooper?
I've been parachute trained, but their motto is knowledge dispels fear. So the more you know about somewhere, again, you're more likely to be able to identify the risks and avoid them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's no longer really a risk. I think a lot of the problem is, and a lot of the problems people get into, is that they just travel somewhere, have no idea where they're going, what they're doing, and first thing they're going to do is leave the airport, jump in the back of a cab, and now you've given control over your life to someone else.
Yeah.
You don't know anything about them.
Yeah.
Was that the right cab to get into? Like, do you really need to get into a cab? Is there a better way to get around? And that's obviously, like, just doing a little bit of research and knowledge on the front end.
Yeah, I'll try even when I land to get on an airport Wi-Fi and just be like, at least like, how much should cabs cost from here to there? Or like, what should I know? Just quick stuff, and then leave the actual gate and then enter into.
Or better still, do that sort of research before you get on the plane.
If you're smart, if you're organized, tell it to somebody else.
So that's sort of how I'm approaching this race, this challenge. Like, I want to try and find out as much as I can on the front end, speak to as many people that have already done it.
That's so smart.
So there are very few, if any, surprises other than the sort of things that are out of my control anyway. But knowing that, a swordfish, a marlin, could attack the boat and pierce the hull.
Really?
Which has happened to a team 2 or 3 years ago.
Oh my gosh.
It's kind of funny. If you search on YouTube, there's a video of it that one of the guys got in to like clean off the bottom of the boat, because obviously you're moving slow, so you have barnacles and other sea life that attach themselves to the boat and slows you down.
So you got
to
clean it.
He jumped in to start scraping and the boat, and found this thing kind of sticking into one of the or sticking in the boat. So they went on and they emptied out the storage sort of section that it was in, and they pull out this 8-inch spike. And they're like, what is it? And then when they had it sort of looked at by, and they went, oh yeah, that's basically the nose of a marlin. And they then think back, like 2 weeks, they did feel this bump in the middle of the night, but thought nothing of it. Yeah, and basically, so had that been further around on the boat, then it could have messed with the integrity of the actual hull, and
yeah,
it could have had water coming in and
what happens? Can you plug up a hole?
Yeah, you can plug it.
Oh.
Either with a rubber plug, or there are other sort of temporary fixes that you can put on there.
Has anybody ever died doing these?
In total of combine the whole ocean rowing as a sport, I think there's been 7 deaths or lives lost at sea. A few of those have gone missing and never recovered. There have been a few that have folks have died aboard, whether it's exposure, heat or cold injuries. But yeah, in total 7, I think.
Well, you're not worried about that?
No.
Okay.
You can walk out here, get hit by a bus, and
yeah,
I think percentages are probably higher.
You're trying to win this. How old are the most entrants?
They vary. So yeah. I think the youngest in this year's race, mm-hmm, I want to say is 19. I think he's going for the youngest solo crossing.
19. Good job.
I think there's been a mother and son team a few years back, and I think he may have been like, I think he might have been 19, 20. But yeah, you get teenagers through to, I don't know what the oldest guy is, I want to say late 60s. In this year's race, I think he is.
And he's going to do it.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's a big spread of kind of age backgrounds. You've got complete novice, never stepped inside a boat at all and no nautical experience, through to salty sea dogs that have done it.
That's crazy to go try to do that without any sort of experience.
Yeah, obviously they're perhaps doing 18 months, 2 years worth of preparation, but... so you mentioned paratroopers. There's a 2-man team that are racing in my race next year or this year, and they're former paratroopers in British Army. So there's some natural rivalry there already between myself and them. I know one of them quite well, and they've said, "Yeah, I think they're both over 60 because their team name is Granddads of the Atlantic. They're good guys, real good guys actually." But they have no maritime experience at all.
What? So, and they're just going to go for it?
Yeah, they're kind of learning it now over the next 6-8 months and will rise to the challenge.
Fuck. What are some of the... Like, it's cool that everyone's pretty forthcoming, by the way.
Yeah.
Like, the other entrants are, like, that you can talk to.
Yeah, so...
Are they usually, like, so sharing?
You've got kind of the race organizers. They've got a forum that you can... share information, and they provide you a lot of information and resources and so forth, but they're fairly neutral in that sense. Then there's a Facebook, there's a couple of different Facebook forums and closed groups that are kind of past, present and future rowers. So there's a lot of back and forth, questions will get raised, people raise comments and it'll go back and forth. There's already a great spirit around kind of the build-up, and then when you get out to La Gomera, so the name of the one group on Facebook is the Blue Marlin group. So Blue Marlin is actually a pub out in the harbor in La Gomera, and that is kind of the place to be and go. When you're out there doing the preparation, and some teams may be out there for a month before the race, some will literally be there just a week before to get all the final race preparations done and requirements met before they get out on the water.
It's a friendly environment?
So yeah, so it's you have that friendly kind of camaraderie while getting everything ready. Like, if you're missing a piece of equipment, someone may lend you a piece of equipment. They will help you get your boat ready, and that. Then there's that kind of friendly rivalry when you're on the water.
Yeah.
And then kind of the support is on the back end when she completed it.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it'd be any cause or help to say, fuck off, you're my competitor.
Yeah, no, I've not seen that in any, and I've not heard of that. Sometimes you get teams will fall out with each other on board.
Oh, really?
yeah, I bet. Because they don't have that team dynamics. Because like some of the, and that's one of the things I don't have to really worry about.
Yeah.
But, some teams actually sit down with a sports psychologist and they go through some of that kind of team dynamic preparation, because if you're going to be stuck on board this small vessel for
I would hate almost all of my friends after that, even after a week of just being alone with them.
If you have an issue with someone, it's going to either make or break you.
Have there been fights?
I'm sure there have been.
Probably, right?
there's an account of... So this race 20 years ago was won by two New Zealand guys. One was an Olympic rower that came to Atlanta. He didn't win there. I don't think they even placed in the 96 Olympics here. And then the other guy was a policeman.
Mm-hmm.
And reading their account of their crossing, they've said, there were moments where they weren't speaking to each other, and like the rower had to kind of literally bury the hatchet in order to start talking again. And then many years later, they sort of found out that there were times that it came very, very close to them having a serious issue mid-Atlantic.
That'd be great. Does anyone fall overboard?
Yeah, some people get sort of swept overboard. So that's one of the requirements. You have to have a safety harness.
And a tether?
You have to be tethered to the boat just in case.
Oh, yeah.
And I think just last week, there were some freak waves that swept a few people overboard, and luckily enough, they were tethered.
How do you know that? You follow the...
So there's the race organizers release a blog every now and again. So the duty officers talk to every boat at least every 24 hours, and then they'll compile all that information and give periodic updates. And then the teams themselves, whether it's them sending updates from the boat direct to their website, or they've done it through their social media platforms and so forth. So you get little snippets, and then you get more detailed updates from the race organizers.
And you don't wear a life preserver?
You do, yes. That's, again, if the weather gets bad, you should put that on. That's it's going to buy you some time if you do get swept overboard and the tether breaks. I think the last person that was lost at sea was that they got swept overboard in rough seas and the tether broke. And
fuck.
By the time they turned around the boat and tried to do anything, they were gone.
Man.
So, whether it's relatively calm, again, you can still have these freak waves that come from nowhere. So, I'll be clipped in whenever I'm out on deck.
Jeez, that must probably be the scariest part, when waves are coming and hitting you.
That's, if you get detached from the boat, then you're basically dead.
Do you wear goggles or anything?
No.
So the water in your eyes is not an issue? Or?
Well, you wear sunglasses or
shades.
I think I've seen in some of the pictures of one of the rowers in this race, they do have clear like sunglasses on, so just probably to stop the spray.
All right.
But it's not really that bad.
Man, I'm excited for you, man.
Mm. Plus, you're obviously winning going backwards. So as you're rowing, if the wind and rain is currently, you're...
Oh, good point.
More on the back of your head, more so than in your face.
Oh, yeah, good point. Good point. I'm so excited for you. This seems so cool.
Yeah, it is. It's good.
Yeah. So you'll be doing this in December.
So, December 12th is the projected start date. Actually, this year's race was delayed by 48 hours because the weather was that bad.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Oh, really?
If everything goes well, December 12th.
December 12th.
We'll start rowing.
What are some of the unexpected things that have been popping up for other people?
So one of the pairs
besides Marlon attack.
He felt ill fairly early on in the race. So he was taken off, and then his partner has continued as a solo.
Oh.
Which sometimes happens. I think a couple of years back, I think several people went down with food poisoning, and that obviously delayed them. A few years back, there was actually a team of U.S. rowers. I mean, they were like Olympic standard rowers, and everyone thought that they were going to break records and do well just because of who they were. And a couple of days into it, one of the rowers got debilitated by his seasickness, requested to be removed. And then when the safety boat came to pick him up, one of the other rowers went, I'm not really into this. And he got off as well. So their four-man team went down to a two-man team.
And they had this boat for four.
And they continued. Yeah. So I think once you've started, if there's no reason why, A, you physically can't, or something is broken on the boat that is going to prevent you from safely crossing, like the amount of time you've put into preparing, why would you want to get off? Many people have said that towards the end, they've felt a little bit down knowing that now it has come to an end. And like their life has consisted of basically eat, row, sleep, repeat for 30 to 50 days. And then they've woken up to some fantastic sunrises and
I bet that's gonna be amazing.
And dolphins and turtles and all kinds of sea life up close and very personal, and been completely cut off from the rest of the world other than what comes through on a small screen periodically, and it's like I said, it's been like life changing.
Yeah, you'll see whales and dolphins.
Yeah, even in this race, very early on in the first week, some of the pictures that folks were sending out of like a pod of dolphins around them following the boat for a couple of days.
Wow.
There's been humorous stories of flying fish like hitting people in the middle of the night and scaring turtles following the boats, whales coming up and being very inquisitive as to kind of who you are, what's going on, and getting on their way.
Is there any danger of whales or attacking or sharks or anything?
Sharks have known certainly towards the latter half of the race where the waters are warmer, but they're not after you or what's in the boat.
Or carbon fiber.
What happens is that the boat creates shade, so you have smaller fish that are in under the boat, and then it's literally like that got cartoon sketch where you've got like small fish, bigger fish, bigger fish, bigger fish, and then a giant shark on the end. And that, again, that's typically what happens, is that the shark starts following you because you've got all the smaller fish that are kind of being served up in the shade of the boat underneath. Some boats have said that they've had sharks follow them for like a couple of weeks, gone away and then either come back or another shark's taken their place.
Is that frightening?
Only if you get in the water, I guess.
Right, yeah.
And other than cleaning the hull of the boat periodically, maybe once or twice during the crossing.
So you got to get out and clean it?
Yeah, you jump overboard and get a little plastic scraper. And
you have a snorkel outfit?
Yeah, you have a mask and snorkel.
And then just go out and scrub it.
Yep.
Oh, wow.
And that obviously speeds up because you haven't got this drag of sea life underneath attached to the boat.
You'll be able to feel the difference as soon as you do it.
That's what a lot of people have said, that once you've cleaned off that, you'll notice that the boat runs a lot truer and cleaner. Wow.
So it's like you don't do it right away, but as soon as it gets too much, because it takes time.
It takes a couple of weeks for stuff to start growing on the bottom of the boat.
A couple weeks. So do you have to like look around for sea life before you jump off and
start
cleaning? That
would probably be advisable, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Make sure you haven't dumped any food that's going to attract anything in, and then get in, give it a quick clean, and jump back out.
Wow. Jeez, it's so fucking cool.
And then obviously when you jump out, that's what a few people have commented on, is that when you jump out, you've literally got a few miles of nothing underneath you. And that can freak some people out.
Yeah. Do you pop your head? Are you going to pop your head down and just try to stare down?
Yeah, probably check and make sure there's no unwanted guests for us before
continuing
the business. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, that'd be so cool. The sunsets and sunrises must be great too.
Yes, I think that's one of the things.
And the moon rises. The stars out there must be tremendous.
Yeah. Oh yes, the stars. That's what some people have commented on, that even fairly early on, within the first week, when you get clear of land, there's no light pollution. So on a clear sky, they've said, "Yeah, okay, we know the Big Dipper, we know Orion, and the constellations that you grow up on." He said, "But there are so many stars and so many constellations that, he feels kind of they should have learned more about some of these stars." And
oh, right. Yeah, I mean, I even walked around here last night, because in New York, you see like a star, maybe two. It's kind of awful.
Yeah.
And then like when I get into the wilderness at any point, it's like one of my favorite things.
Yeah.
We were on a boat, for a ferry in between two like Indonesian islands, and then just getting up on top of the hull.
Yeah.
Way up top where there's no, it's just amazing up there. Yeah. And new moons before the moon has risen.
Yeah.
God damn, it's just great.
Yeah, it's surprising. And that's one of the biggest, I think, polluters on the planet is light now.
Yeah.
Is there any big city, it's hard to imagine what a night sky actually looks like.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we were driving the Grand Canyon. We had to just get out at some point, and just before the moon came up.
Yeah.
And just like, yeah, it's like breathtaking, those stars. Does anybody bring like a joint or two on the boat with them?
Not that I've heard, no, because... I don't know what the laws are in Spain, but you've obviously got to clear customs and get through on there. Even though you're crossing through, obviously, a number of different smuggling routes, but I doubt that would be advantageous to.
I mean, probably not, but I want like at least a hit or two every 2 weeks.
Maybe, just to be like, that's something that they would kind of look forward to once they've got to the Caribbean. And,
oh, there you go. Yeah, exactly. Go straight to Jamaica. The
Caribbean spirits.
And, yeah.
Even though I'm not sure, I've never been to Antigua, so I'm not sure kind of what the culture is there.
Do you think you're going to have, when you land, are you going to have, I get this like, I'll do like comedy specials is my big like thing that I gear up for. And when I'm done, you know, with 6 months of preparation, and then I get this like, I compare it mostly like postpartum depression of like everything I've been pushing towards. And I know brides get this after weddings. Where it's like, now what?
Yeah, now what?
Yeah.
I hadn't really thought about it, but yeah, again, looking at or listening to some of the accounts of what folks have felt like after they've finished. And it's different from those that have either won the race and finished early. They've maybe stayed in Antigua for a week, 10 days, maybe a couple of weeks, and kind of cheered other teams in as they arrived, and it's become more of a family / kind of holiday experience, and they won, so they've probably dealt with it better than those teams that have sort of come in towards the latter part, and then okay, 2 or 3 days everyone's left, and maybe you stay there for a couple of days, but there hasn't been that kind of party atmosphere.
There's no one left there.
And then they've gone back and they're like, I've just struggled across the land for 60 days. Like, you've had a quick pat on the back and now it's back to your normal life, whatever that may be. So I would imagine that could be a bit of a struggle. And unless you've had to deal with some other challenge along the way that then you could perhaps speak to.
Like what do you mean?
It's not that you're going to like come in, say, last, and then go on a speaking tour to say, hey, look what I did.
Right.
And I came last. Unless there was, I know, maybe you came last because you had to battle off sharks and hurricanes and all those sort of things that, again, are newsworthy. If you come first, then obviously you can, oh, I came first and I did this, and you probably can maintain that party atmosphere perhaps a little bit longer. On a speaking circuit, going back to your sponsors, that sort of stuff. So, yeah, still a long way to go to that yet.
Jeez. That sounds so fun. All right. Is there anything else you want to tell me about it?
No, I think we covered a lot there.
And for sure.
Off on a couple of different tangents, but No, like I said, I'm happy to keep you posted. And,
yeah.
And if anyone's got any questions, I don't know how they contact you through your site.
Well, let's say Release the Kraken is your website.
No, Tame the Kraken.
Tame the Kraken. Oh, yeah. Jesus. Yeah. Oh, Release the Kraken
Release the Kraken was our sort of inaugural 24-hour rowing event. So tamethekraken.com. All the information's up there. You can message the campaign.
Yeah, I'll have all this on my website for arishafira.com.
So any questions? If anyone wants to donate, they can donate. Great. If they want to get involved more,
yeah,
then please do so. Follow us on Facebook. You can find Tame the Kraken on there. Instagram and also Twitter. Obviously, one of the things we
Tame the Kraken. You have that?
Yep.
On Twitter. So
Instagram
pictures are going to be great.
On Twitter, actually, it's Row Atlantic is the name. But
okay.
Instagram and Facebook seem to be getting the most hits at the moment.
Twitter's dying.
We're obviously encouraging people to follow the campaign because a lot of our potential sponsors are asking how big is your social media following.
Oh.
So obviously they're probably trying to calculate their ROI and
oh yeah. So yeah, everybody follow Tim on Tame the Kraken for sure
now. Follow us. If you can't find us, just message us through the website and we'll direct you. But again, all the links are up on the website and you can click on any of those to find us where we are.
And a big thanks to Delta and FedEx for sponsoring you.
Yeah, yeah. or maybe UPS. They're another hometown company here.
Oh, okay. UPS,
We'll take anything and everything.
Yeah, if you run a business and you want to get involved in this, if you're the guy in your business.
For tasty treats and food and freeze-dried expedition foods, you can feed me.
Oh, yeah, you get sponsors like that, people that have those companies.
I'll accept goods in kind. It doesn't have to be a financial donation or support. It can be goods in kind. I've had Ritchie Navigation is a sponsor of mine, so they've donated a couple of
systems,
compasses to have on board to hopefully keep me pointing in the right direction. So yeah, we'll take goods in kind. So yeah, if you happen to have maritime safety equipment, satellite phones, airline tickets, we'll take them all.
Yeah,
it'll help get us to where we need to be.
Oh, it's so fucking rad. And right, probably I'll wait till you build a website to release this. But or I'll let you tell me when you want to release it. But the Talisker race will still probably be going.
So I would imagine
this year.
So we will probably see the first boats come in within the next 10 days.
The groups.
For the leaders. I think there's still about 25 boats in the race. So you're talking the next 30 days that the boat's still going to be coming into Antigua.
Wow.
And we'll be giving updates from there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to have a Talisker tonight.
There you go. That's it. And think about it. Yeah. You can either have the sky or the storm. They've named their whiskeys differently.
Oh, really?
I think you've got sky. One's called storm. And I can't remember what the third one is.
Really? I'm just used to a regular Talisker. Maybe it's sky and I've just not noticed.
Yeah.
Oh, I got to take a look at the bottle now.
Try some of the other varieties.
Yeah, for sure. I almost went by there when I was in Edinburgh and went north.
Yeah,
I saw their distillery. All right, Tim, thanks a lot, man.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it. Yeah,
enjoyed it.
A pleasure
meeting
you. Yeah, I'm glad we could do this.
Thank you. I don't have a lot, but with me that's fine. Whatever I got, well, I know it's mine. Don't go around with a local crowd. I don't dig what's in, so I guess I'm out. I'm saying these things so you know me, baby, so you understand what I'm all about. The boat that I row won't cross no ocean. The boat that I row won't get me there soon. But I got the love and if you got the notion. Big enough for two, it's me and you. There ain't a man alive can tell me what to say. I choose my own side and I like it that way. I don't worry about all the things that I'm not. There's only one thing that I want and got.
die soon. But I got the love and you got the notion. Both that I wrote big enough for two. With me and you.
That is the episode. Thank you, Tim Crockett, for coming through. Drove 2 fucking hours from Atlanta to Athens to do that with me. So, I mean, good luck, man. Good luck. I'll be checking in with him again for sure as he gets ready to do this. But it's such a crazy undertaking. I just think it's so fucking rad. This guy's an adventurer. He's like a real adventurer. I mean, I'm jealous of him. There's no doubt. I'm jealous of that. So, that's it. All right. That's it. That's the episode, you guys. Thank you very much for tuning in. Thank you very much to my sponsor, you people, for tuning in and telling all your friends about Skeptic Tank. I can keep doing cool shit like this. When I hear about it, I'm getting back into the groove a little bit. I just got to, like, keep my mind open to, like, who has good stories about things. I get going again. Now that I'm on the road, it's like a major thing. But thank you, Tim Crocker, for coming down and doing it. Thank you for Aubrey over at Onnit for sponsoring Tim's boat, Tame the Kraken. I mean, in fairness, he's not sponsoring the boat, but he should. Onnit, you should sponsor Tim's boat. What better matchup would there be? He's a fucking athlete like crazy, special forces, and he's doing it to raise money for fucking suicide prevention among veterans. That's your fucking brand, bro. That's your brand. And you're helping some guy do something crazy. How many other Onnit members do you have that are rowing across the Atlantic? I don't know. I mean, do what you want with your ad dollar, but this just seems like a perfect match. I mean, Donald Cerrone's not rowing across the Atlantic. You know, he's out there fucking doing mutters and big truck competitions. He's lassoing deer. Why not get someone else? Cowboy. Why not get somebody else who fucking rows across the Atlantic? It seems like a good matchup to me, Onnit. It seems like a good matchup, but, you know, it ain't my dollar. As a holder of both American and British passports, this is what it says on his website. I'm doing this for a very good reason. My name is Tim Crockett, and I'm going to row a 23-foot boat, the Kraken, across the Atlantic Ocean. I'm doing this for a very good reason. As a holder of both American and British passports, and being a Special Forces veteran, I am painfully aware that many U.S. and U.K. soldiers are struggling with thoughts of suicide brought on by PTSD. The journey I face is my way to raise awareness, funding, and to support their cause. My pending journey is part of the 2018 Talisker Whiskey Atlantic Challenge, a race of more than 3,000 nautical miles from the Canary Islands to Antigua across the Atlantic Ocean, considered by some to be one of the toughest challenges on Earth. More people have scaled Everest or have journeyed into space than have rowed across the Atlantic. Even fewer have rowed it solo. More people have journeyed into space than have rowed across the Atlantic. While I'll be alone in the Atlantic, I need your help to get me there. Look at all this on TameTheKraken.com. He even has a countdown clock of how long he's going to go. 332 days, 11 hours, 10 minutes. My boat, the Kraken, symbolizes the struggle many experience when dealing with mental health issues and PTSD. Those that have gone through or are going through traumatic events need to know that just like the limbs of the Kraken can grow back, so should one's life continue to grow after a difficult phase. Oh, I didn't know that about Krakens. Yeah, cool episode, huh? Cool episode. Thank you very much, everybody, for tuning in. Don't forget, Denver this Wednesday, and then Thursday, Saturday will be stories about women. Friday, stories about friendship. If we add a show, any shows we add, either a late show Thursday or an early show Saturday, that'll also be stories about friendship. Thanks a lot, you guys. Oh, and then, of course, Boston, Providence, no, Providence is sold out. Boston and Foxwoods on the 27th and 26th of January. Helium in Philadelphia, February 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. Those Boston dates were January with Joe List. And Philadelphia's with Jessica Michelle Singleton. Go Eagles, I guess. Go Eagles. Now that Atlanta's out, fucking ass fuck Tebow's dreams are crushed yet again. I guess I can root for the team to knock him out. And then Salt Lake City, Boise, Calusa Casino in NorCal, Vancouver, and Edmonton. Australia coming soon. Everything is at AriTheGreat.com. All right, you guys. Thanks a lot for tuning in. Have a good night.
Michael rowed the boat ashore. Hallelujah. Michael rowed the boat ashore. Hallelujah. Sister helped to trim the sails. Hallelujah. Sister helped to trim the sails. But not the soul. Alleluia. Michael rowed the boat ashore. Alleluia. Michael rowed the boat ashore. Alleluia. The river is deep and the river is wide.